Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the School Board Workshop, Volusia County Schools. Today is June 14th, and we will start our workshop work session for today. If everyone can please stand for the Pledge of Allegiance, I'd appreciate it.
Flag of the United States of America, and Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible.
All right, we'll start off by introducing the amazing folks on the dais. This time we'll start with our superintendent, a little different, Ms. Rachel Hazel. Next to Ms. Hazel, we have Vice Chairwoman Jamie Haynes. Next to Jamie Haynes, we have, I'm going backwards, I messed up my order here. We have Ms. Anita Burnett representing District 2. Next to Ms. Burnett, we have Ms. Erin Lieben, our amazing agency clerk over on the left-hand side. We have Mr. Carl Persis representing District 4 and Mrs. Linda Cuthbert representing District 3. Mr. Doran is en route. And my name is Ruben Colon. I have the honor and pleasure of serving as the chair this year. On the agenda today, we have two items. The first one is school board policies and revisions, and the second one is financial services budget presentation. Superintendent.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman Colon. For this one, I would like to call General Counsel Kevin Penley to the dais to review policies and revisions. As you know, we have been anxiously awaiting the review of several of our policies, and he's joined by Ms. Harrington.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, board members. Let me get situated here. This one might settle in for a while. And unlike my customary three sentences and done and back over there, we have a little bit of work to do this afternoon. There are, as you will recall, a provision in our settlement with the Department of Justice requiring that we update and revise our policies to be in compliance with the Americans with Disabilities Act Title II. Subsumed within that are also revisions to be in compliance with Section 504 and additional language that complies with the IDEA as well, the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. But essentially, what we're doing today is looking at a dozen policies, 12 policies that we have worked extensively with the lawyers at the Department of Justice over the last 8 to 10 months. This has not been a short process on our side, but it has resulted in making our policies in these 12 areas in compliance with already existing law. Keep in mind, this does not mean that any of our policies were not already in compliance. It just adds language specifying how we're going to either procedurally or administratively address these concerns as they come up, also with a procedural, as we've already talked about and you've already approved, a procedure for any complaints that come forward. That's already in place. So these language changes, let me get my computer to cooperate here, will be necessary going forward. Ms. Harrigan has worked extensively with both the local Assistant United States Attorneys and the legal compliance team in Washington to craft this language. And I'm going to ask her to go through. We have, for your notes, Policy 206 concerning student attendance, 208, our student code of conduct, both elementary and secondary, so 208E and 208S, 216 concerning communicable diseases, 217 concerning student dress code, and I know nobody likes to revisit the student dress code, and it's an iffy proposition we'll get to, but we do have some language to propose to clarify accommodations under the dress code policy should that be necessary. Policy 315 concerning field trips, Policy 504, transportation, Policy 507, non-discrimination and educational equity. The grievance procedure will be incorporated at Policy 508. Policy 509, prohibition of harassment that already exists. We're clarifying some language there. Policy 510, safety and security. And Policy 525, policy against bullying and harassment. So I'm going to ask Ms. Harrigan if she will kick it off and tell us what changes are being proposed for advertisement to Policy 206.
Is this, you guys can hear me okay? So for Policy 206, on page 2 of the proposed policy, you have Roman numeral 1G, excused absences for the treatment of autism spectrum disorder. This is already a statute. We just need to have it in
which,
here.
Which policy are
I'm
you
sorry.
In? I'm
206.
Sorry.
206.
So it's 1913 in our regular.
Thank you. Got it. Thank you. All right, let's do this.
So it's 206. It's Roman numeral 1G, which is on page 2. And it's the excused absences for the treatment of autism spectrum disorder section. It's already in Florida statute and the Florida Rules of Administrative Code. It's just being incorporated into the policy in Word. So it's what we've already done. We're just putting it here so that we can point to it now when people ask. 7.
Okay, so let's, right. Yep, so Ms. Haynes, do you have a question?
Right. So under this Section G, everything that you have listed here does go back to what's already in, like, the state language, right?
Yes, ma'am.
And so if I understand this correctly, we're stating that if an autistic student misses, you know, 3 days a week from 11 to 12 because they're receiving therapeutic services during that time that are specific to them, that we are going to excuse that because that is a part of the because we may not provide those services within the school setting, and they may go out, for example, for ABA therapy or specified a more detailed speech and language plan or OT or PT. Is that what I'm understanding on this part?
Sort of. We do provide the services. Parents are permitted to elect private practitioners. If they miss from 11 to 3 days a week, they're allowed to do that until it starts to interfere with our ability to provide them with FAPE. And then we have to have a conversation about what to do next. It's not telling them no. It's not anything like that. It's just initiating a conversation.
All right. Thank you. I'm actually happy to see that part in there because I know that sometimes these students come to us and they've already been receiving the therapy services and they're comfortable with, like, their therapist plan and the parents feel more comfortable, and they need that time, some, especially if they come to us at 3, to transition, say, you know, from that. Because lots of times if you change those kids' schedules, then we actually put them into a situation where they'll have a meltdown.
Absolutely.
I support that part.
We can go on.
Okay. So on page 7 of 206, we have Roman numeral 14, which is classroom removals. This was a big area of the settlement agreement. And basically, it just goes over our documentation policy and how we're going to document in focus when we have a removal from the classroom, and how to make sure that any removal from the classroom continues to be the least restrictive environment. In 208E and 208S, the...
Hold on.
I'm sorry.
So where are we going now?
208E.
Which is 19.03 and 19.04.
Correct, yeah.
I don't have a preference.
No, you can go ahead, Ms. Cuthbert.
Back to 206.
Absolutely.
206. Page 8. Find the exact number. It has to do with an ESE student who has misbehaved. who should be removed. However, we cannot deny that student instruction. My point is, as a former classroom teacher, I knew that students had that right, especially ESC students. Now, when you have regularly trained, even veteran teachers, how do those teachers handle that? We know the law, and I'm sure people will be trained and be given this information about the law, but how do they not deny, how do they do not deny that student who has misbehaved to be removed from instruction? What support does that teacher have in the classroom? So if you remove the child to go to an assistant principal or the ESC or to discipline, you're removing that child from the class and you're denying that child the right to education. So what does that teacher do? What's the dilemma? How do we handle that?
Let me take this one, if I could, through the chair, please. We're talking about the length of the removal. So long-term versus short-term removals are very important under IDEA. So what we have determined with Department of Justice's cooperation is a short-term removal, for example, or a de minimis removal, like you suggest, sending the student to the assistant principal for something. That's not counted toward this removal.
I see. This is long-term removal. What is
correct? If the removal contemplated is one of 10 school days or more cumulative during the school year, you have what is known as a long-term removal. The IEP team, one, if it's a removal due to a behavioral incident related to the disability, there has to be a manifestation determination review. The team gets together, determines whether the IEP was being followed and if the behavior was a manifestation of the student's qualifying disability. In those circumstances where a long-term removal is contemplated, the IEP team, including the parent's input, must determine where the student is going to receive services necessary to allow them to make progress toward the goals and objectives of the IEP.
Okay, so
that's a different kind of removal than what we're contemplating in this policy.
So this policy is for long-term removal, 10 days or more. Okay, so that MTSS, MSTS, I think it's MT, multi-tier. Okay, that has to be taken that has to be taken place for the student and the parents within that 10 days?
No, the manifestation determination review would occur during the 10 days of removal.
That's what I meant.
The MTSS process is a child find process where you're seeing a pattern of conduct that the team hasn't, at the regular ed level has not addressed. You may move to a tier two with more supports and interventions for that student, up to a tier three, which would mean that you have an opportunity to evaluate the student and make a determination if they have a qualifying disability. That's a different process than what we're talking about with a behavioral removal that might be the result of a manifestation of the student's disability who already has an identified disability. That's a manifestation determination review, an MDR.
So our new ESE administrators have to be made aware of all of this specifically. Our ESE teachers do. Now, for the mainstreamed students who are in regular ed classrooms, that's something a new regular ed teacher needs to be made aware of this as well, correct?
Absolutely. Keep in mind that even without the settlement agreement, which we entered into in July of 2021, we have extensive training components for everyone on our campus. Regular ed, special ed, it doesn't matter. Schoolway cafe workers, if they're going to be coming into contact with students with disabilities. Bus drivers, certainly our guardians and SRDs and SROs, we train them. Training on this piece will be ongoing. It is not just a function of policy, it's a function of operations. So we would continue to do that throughout, and we'll do that on an annual basis going forward.
Can we create, or maybe it's already in existence, a pamphlet or a file, or it can be online, something that, because you may not have an incident like this for months, and then all of a sudden it pops up in December. And then we tend to forget because we're all involved in the day-to-day workings of education. Is there some way that people can be reminded or a way to go, a place to go to just in case? If you encounter this problem, go to this area. Especially as a regular ed teacher, you know, I taught AP classes, I had honors classes, but I still had gifted as well as other students who are mainstream. But at times I wouldn't have problems, but then it would pop up, and then I would be at the mercy of a guidance counselor or the ESE administrator letting me know what I did correctly or what I didn't do correctly. And but then we have parents who are upset, maybe other parents who were affected of students who were involved in this altercation. Those parents don't understand what's happening. So in I guess in the deputy superintendent who we're going to have eventually in charge of teaching, learning, and leading, I think that is that something that we could create or have so we know where to go to find the proper way to do things.
I'm looking over my right shoulder at Ms. Wiles. This is part of what she does on a monthly basis with our administrators. She wants to come up and address it more specifically, but the training and dissemination of information piece is an ongoing process, both for administrators, teachers, ESE teachers, paras. Everyone gets this training on a very frequent, if not monthly, basis. I know that the principals receive a monthly. She's on all the principal meetings, and we talk about both child find issues, compliance issues. We also, in addition, you mentioned how the parents would know. We have a collaborative effort with parents where, I believe it's a monthly basis for the task force, and special ESE parents have a roundtable discussion in the evenings that Ms. Wiles hosts and can address any questions about the ESE process and how MTSS Child Find works with that as well.
Also, my concern is the day-to-day incident on campus. That's something that I just want to make sure, knowing if I were hired at new to the county, or as a veteran teacher, if I would return to the classroom, things have changed drastically, especially in the last couple of years. Where do I go to be? I mean, I might have training, but then I'm thinking, I've got 2 hours that I have to be in here, and I'm out of here. So I guess old school, I need something to go back to refer to make sure I'm fair in the classroom, or else be called on the carpet. That's happened to me before. I was pulled into an IEP meeting and accused of not following the IEP or the proper procedure, which I wasn't aware of. So I just want to, in the future, to protect the student first of all, so the student's IEP rights are adhered to, but also to instructors who may find that happening. So I just wanted to bring that up because I think this issue is very much needed, very much we need to address it, and there's training, I perfectly understand, but I also know that we need to support the people on the ground, school counselors, teachers, even administrators who are not ESE, but do lunch duty every day and are aware of that. So it's just the day-to-day. I didn't know if we have any procedures or protocols in place of what to do when you see it. Something very simple, like what I would need in the operation of a microwave or how to operate my phone. If this happens, this is what you do. If this happens, this is what you do.
So we are in the process of implementing MTSS, which is the multi-tiered system of supports. And they actually just started having the trainings on them. So people spent 2 days last week and 2 days this week, I believe, learning the different standards. And the whole purpose is that everyone will be supported. So the IEP or the BIP or the 504, that is there so that you can be in your learning environment, the least restrictive learning environment. So a student who 30, 40 years ago might have been thrown in an isolated ESE room is now in general education because they only need a little bit of support to be able to be with their peers. So that IEP helps them be with their peers. So what we're going to start doing is the multi-tiered system of support. So the administrative, the coaches that are on campus, the instructors, the teachers, everybody is going to be working together to say these kids have IEPs or these kids don't have IEPs, but these things are flagging us behaviors or academic-wise. And so they're going to allow us to have these bigger conversations of support, and so we're going to document when there's deviations from those so that we know that we can work on better supporting everyone.
Well done. And sitting back there going, So you mentioned other APs. I train every AP monthly. Everybody has my cell phone, and they know if they have emailed me and I have not responded to that email in a day and a half, 2 days, they text me. So as you can imagine, even little things come up, they text me and ask, you know, how do I handle this? And if you ask any of them, I'm pretty good about getting back with them to make sure, especially as we're moving through this DOJ settlement, we're changing our policies. You know, me, my team, we're very responsive to those questions. But the training piece has been very important and very helpful for all of our administrators. I've been in front of the TOAs as well twice this past year. Next year, it will be monthly for the TOAs, because they are our future administrators, and I want to make sure that they understand it from the ground up, providing the right supports, giving the students everything that they need. Something that we also implemented this year, every student with an IEP or a behavior plan or a crisis plan, every adult on that campus that touches that student has a responsibility to that IEP or that behavior plan, signs that they are aware. They sign that they're aware there's a behavior plan, an IEP. They understand what their responsibility is. So that was new this school year. If the student has a related service and it's for transportation, the bus driver and the attendant signs as well. So we have that documentation that they have been shown exactly what they need and exactly what they're responsible for providing to that student.
Now, does the schools help bus drivers? Because a lot of times, the end of the school day, they're finally free of construction, restrictive behavior, and then they let go once they get on that bus. Are bus operators now aware of which students, does the school tell them
yes.
what to look for?
Yes. They're given a copy of those behavior plans for students with a behavior plan. Now, of course, some students don't yet have a behavior plan. It is the expectation. I do have that conversation with assistant principals to make sure that they're touching base. And, you know, the buses with the attendants on them often have students that are higher need. So we do have those conversations regularly. We are training the bus drivers and the bus attendants. And Ben Springer, our behavior consultant, will be in front of them as well. So we're pulling everybody that we can that is responsible for any piece of that IEP into conversations and into trainings.
Because when you might have two or three of those on a bus, and then the bus driver has to watch where he or she is going.
Right. And that's why we usually have attendants on those. Not always, but usually. And, you know, we do have a shortage. We also assist in giving suggestions where the kids should sit. And the drivers and the attendants are very responsive to that. You're welcome.
Board, if we can be a little bit louder, for some reason on YouTube we're really, really low. I think they're having some volume issues, and so if we could be a little bit louder and be a little bit more about, because you're right up on the mic.
I'll use my teacher voice.
Yeah, you all who have teacher voices, please and thank you. Just, I don't know what's going on, but if we can be louder so folks can hear us, I'd appreciate it. Ms. Haynes?
Okay, so to piggyback on what Mrs. Cuthbert was saying, things that have been brought to my attention this year are cases where a student is out of control on more than one occasion. They're removed from the classroom for a very short period of time, having disrupted the learning of all of the other students, and then they turn right around and they come back in. And they come back in with candy or a sticker or, you know, things like that. And so then the students that are there trying to learn are struggling because this kid just totally, you know, disrupted the classroom. And sometimes it's a little bit violent, and then they're out for a short period of time and they're back. Or they're showing up on campus and they just act out in each, like, say, middle school, each class period, because then I'm out of class. And then when it's talked about maybe a different type of setting for them, the parent says, no, I don't want that setting. So, you know, when I look at number three, where it says in the rare circumstances that it should be necessary to remove the student from campus because the student is at imminent risk of seriously harming themselves or others, involuntary removal code, either H1 or H2, can be used. So my piece with this, and this piggybacks on what Ms. Cuthbert's saying, is it requires a lot of training for people to understand, but inappropriate behavior should not be rewarded, all right? And when inappropriate behavior is rewarded, then that says to the students that are exhibiting appropriate behavior that, oh, well, wait, maybe I want to follow and do what this child just did, because then I'll get the sticker or the piece of candy, or I get to walk around the campus with, you know, the assistant principal, or go hang out in the media center and things like that. So I appreciate the training that you're doing, okay? My concern is that maybe the training that you're doing is not yet fully understood by the people that you're training, like what's appropriate and inappropriate, and that it's not trickling down to the classroom teacher. Because when a classroom teacher, I mean, if a child throws a desk and then they're back in that classroom in 10 minutes, we've got to disconnect there, because those students lost instruction, that someone could have been harmed, the kid got out, you know, achieved their goal of not having to do instruction, and they're back in there. And if we have these alternative sites that we're using to try to deal with some of these extreme behaviors, does a parent really get the choice for them not to go to an alternative site? Because that's some of what's been brought to me this year.
Yes, so there's a lot in that question. So if a student has been put up for expulsion and they're a student with a disability, we do have to go through that manifestation termination review. If it is determined a manifestation of their disability, then we have a few options. But the parent does have to agree with those options because it is a manifestation of the disability. If it's not a manifestation of the disability, it then becomes the IEP team's decision. Okay. You mentioned earlier a change in placement because there's an IEP meeting and the student needs more services, but the parent disagrees. In those cases, let's say we're sitting around the IEP team table and we're looking at the data, and we've decided this student needs more intensive supports, which can occur in this classroom over here. That is a team decision. That does not rest on the parents' shoulders. And of course, we want the parents' support, we want the parents' input, and we always try to show the parent why this. But ultimately, it's the team's decision at that point.
Because I'm not going to name any names or schools or whatever, but I'll give an example. You know, a child comes on campus, and five out of the six or seven periods, they're not even staying in class. They're hanging out in the media center, or they're hanging out in the front office because they won't do the work. You know, so at what point, you know, but we're adding an extra burden to the teacher, you know, to provide that work. And that student's getting away with it. And when something is said, it's like, well, the parent, you know, this is what the parent wants. Well, I'm all for parent rights, okay? But we have to look at the good of the entire student body. And I've taught Gen Ed and I've taught ESE, all right? So I've been on both sides of this. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there are times when it's very easy automatically to just say it's a manifestation of their disability, where I disagree. It's a choice, and it's a learned and allowed behavior that is coming from home that is not, you know, like, you can tell a difference between a meltdown because, let's just take an autistic child, okay? That meltdown has happened because something's changed in their routine, all right? Mm-hmm. Versus a student that may be learning disabled who is just allowed to do whatever they want at home and thinks they can come on campus and continue to do whatever they want and that you can't do anything because the immediate flag thrown is it's a manifestation of
absolutely
my disability.
And we have two questions that we have to answer in those IEP team meetings. You know, are we implementing the IEP with fidelity, yes or no? And then that helps you take a direction. Or is the behavior a direct result of the disability? Now, if a student is SLD, let's say, it may or may not be. A lot of times it's not a result of the disability for that behavior. I think a lot of times what it comes down to, and I think I've addressed this before with all of you, is are we implementing the IEP with fidelity, which also means a behavior plan. So we have to make sure, and this is part of our training that we do every month, making sure that we are tracking those behaviors, looking for those patterns, putting things in place to help that student be successful. If we're doing everything correctly and the student's still having these behaviors, then maybe it's not a manifestation. You know, we have a lot of people with their hands in this and continued training to make sure that we're all answering those questions the way they need to be answered. And I've given the folks at the table the authority to pause a meeting if they're not sure of something and call somebody higher to get some help, get them in that meeting, and let's discuss it again. You know, this does not fall on one person's shoulders to answer. If it's a manifestation or not, because sometimes it is a tricky question. You know, you don't know what's going on with that student, maybe in particular, let's say an EBD student, right? So we do involve as many people as possible to make sure we're answering those right. Are we perfect? No. But we really try to learn from any type of mistake that we have and make sure that we're doing what's best, not only for that student with a disability, but for everybody in the school.
The one thing that I'd like to see, if at all possible, happen to start this school year off is that our leadership teams and everyone knows it's okay to document exactly what's happening because, you know, the biggest push last year when all of this rolled out was they felt like they couldn't write referrals. Like, people were told, you can't write referrals. And or that was their perception.
Right.
You know, the perception was, we can't write referrals. We can't have, you know, other consequences. We can't, you know, send a student home. We can't put them up for exposure. And right. So this is exactly how it was described to me when in December/January the statement was made, well, you know, I think you guys misunderstood at the beginning of the year what was shared with you. Well, whether they misunderstood it or not, that was the general consensus out there, is that we have to not write referrals or things like that. That was the general consensus. So all of a sudden in December and January when it was like, oh, no, you can write them, well, we just spent half of a year. And at an elementary level, you can probably pull that back in and they can get it. At a high school level, where for half of the year kids have gotten away with, you know, inappropriate behavior, acting out, you're not going to pull it back in. I mean, for half of a year, this is how they've lived. You're now not going to change that behavior. And, you know, we saw the video clips this year. We saw videos being posted on social media of out-of-control behavior. Let's talk about the gentleman from DeLand High that picked that other kid up and just dropped him on his head and all that. You know, that behavior can't continue because that's what parents are seeing on social media. Mm-hmm. And then they're fearful of sending their kids from elementary to middle,
right,
or from middle to high. And I need our administrators to know that it's okay to write referrals for inappropriate behavior and that there's consequences and that we're going to support them and back them up regardless of what this says, because that can't happen anymore.
Documentation is key, and that has been what I've shared since last summer. Things happen. You have to document it. So not writing referrals is not okay. And that has been, at least for my office, the consistent message to administration. You have to document everything that happens. If it's not written down, then there's nothing we can do to provide assistance. So documentation has to continue. And then we find what that student needs to help them be successful. If they reach a certain number of days by December, then what are we doing? Or what are we not doing? That's what we have to find out so we can get them the help that they need so that they can be successful. Because there is the law that we have to abide by. And making sure, you know, I every month send emails with numbers to make sure everybody knows exactly how many days each student has. And if a student reaches a certain threshold, where is that meeting? We need to sit down and look at the child as a whole to see what they need so that they can stay in school.
Well, and I personally feel, especially at the middle and high school level, those students need to be involved in the discussion and understand.
Absolutely.
And when it comes to elementary, typically fourth and fifth graders, you know, most of them can be involved. A kindergartner may not necessarily understand.
Right.
But I want to start this coming school year off on the right foot, that we are ensuring parents that are sending their children to be educated that they're going to be in a safe environment to
Absolutely.
Be educated, and that if behaviors put them in an unsafe, we're going to deal with the types of behaviors. At the same time, I want our families that have ESE children, regardless of what area that they need the assistance in, that we are going to also provide them what they need, but we're not going to allow people to be harmed. I
Absolutely.
Mean, that's what it has to come down to. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Persis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to say I thought the critical piece in all of this was, I think it was written in number 4B4, what we were getting into a habit of doing was calling parents and saying, you know, mm-hmm. Johnny's having a bad day.
Right.
You may want to come pick him up and take him home. So we can't do that.
Can't do that.
Yeah, can't do that. And I think just having that sort of training, even though Johnny's having a bad day, he's either going to be documented that he is
That's right.
he is suspended out of
mm-hmm.
school, or we deal with Johnny
Correct.
And we don't.
And that's become second nature, truthfully.
Not that you can't call a parent and say, you know,
right.
he's having a bad day. He can. You want to talk to him and calm him down or get him mm-hmm. back on track, but certainly can't coerce the parent to come get him and
right.
take him home. Yeah, that's good.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right, we can go on if there's no other questions. So which is the next policy we're looking at?
8E.
Thanks, Jamie. All right, Elementary Code of Conduct.
And the, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, please proceed.
Okay, 208E and 208S are both code of conducts, one's for elementary, one's for secondary. The specific paragraphs that we're changing are different in the two, but the content is the same. So there's stuff in the secondary that's not in the elementary, driving cars and things like that. So it puts the paragraphs off. So I'm going to go through both of them, but the content is not different. So the content that we're changing in E is being changed in S and vice versa. So the first part is on page 1, that third paragraph there. One of the things that DOJ asked us to do is to make sure that everybody was aware where the incorporated policies are. So we're making references to board docs throughout the policies so that they know that this is the code of conduct, but the code of conduct includes all the policies that are on board docs, and to please refer to them before feeling like something was missing. So there's a transportation policy, there's a field trip policy, to make sure that you're incorporating everything into this. Page 2, first sentence under safety and security, we are adding this to align with Title II and the Florida Rules of Administration.
James?
So you're talking about first sentence under in red under backpacks?
No, is the first paragraph under safety and security underlined? It says the following safety and security protocols apply to all students, including students with disabilities. The application and enforcement of the safety protocols for a student with disabilities, however, must be in accordance.
That's under earbuds. I'm looking at the part you added under backpacks.
I can skip to that part. I apologize. I don't see what you're seeing, but the
that backpack. So under safety and security, there's basically a sentence that says with the increase of security awareness and protocol. Then it says backpacks,
okay.
And you have a section there. Then it says earbuds in the part you're referencing is under earbuds.
Okay.
So is ours different than yours?
It does look like that. The following safety protocols is going to go at the top. That was requested by DOJ. It is not. Obviously, it's just formatting, but they wanted that to be there to make sure that everybody was on notice, that everybody gets applied the same rules. We just had to make sure that we're following Title II and the administrative code for students with disabilities.
Okay. So... All right, and that I don't have a problem with. It's just in a different location
okay,
on
I apologize.
What we're looking at. So what I was referencing was the part under the backpacks.
Right.
You can look.
It's the content is the same. We just moved the entire paragraph.
I think what's on board docs is different than what you have in front of you.
Apologize.
Because I'm seeing the same thing that Ms. Haynes is seeing.
So under backpacks, it says
under
all
backpacks,
visitors
mm-hmm,
to Volusia County sites and events are on notice that searches may be conducted at random without cause by the site administrator.
With electronic devices.
Here, I'm going to bring you
okay.
Mine.
Okay, so my section, the section that I have a concern with is the backpack section.
Okay.
And the new language you've added that, as Mr. Clone said, so reads, all visitors to Volusia County school sites or events are on notice that searches may be conducted at random and without cause by the site administrator. I don't know how we can just randomly select somebody walking into a football event and go, we're going to check your backpack. And we have no cause. I'm struggling with that piece. Now, I'd be fine if you wanted to switch this and said people needed to show up with clear, that happens at a lot of events, but just to randomly select someone and you don't even have any cause for why you're selecting them. And I'm going to give an example. I'm going to use my own son for something, and I didn't even know about this till about 2 weeks ago, and I guess it happened like 3 years ago with him. So he's 29 years old, and he has his concealed weapons permit, all right? But he also knows that there are places that you go that there's signs posted that says you can't take in, a weapon, and he follows those rules, all right? But at one point in time, he went to Disney Springs, and there were no signs posted that said you could not have a concealed weapon. There was nothing that said you could not have a gun or whatever. And so he was entering Disney Springs with a friend, and the next thing he knew, and Disney Springs doesn't even require a ticket, nothing to purchase to come in. Here came some guys, and they said, are you by any chance carrying a concealed weapon? And if you look at him, I have no idea when he's carrying one or not carrying one. I'm being honest with you, okay? Because that's the way he carries it. It's designed that way. And he looked at them and he said, yes, he was honest and said, yes, I'm carrying it. There's not a sign here that says that I can't. How is it you have selected me? They selected him based on the type of shirt he was wearing and who sells the shirt. So that was not a random selection. That was they were looking at the clothing individuals were wearing and made a determination to stop him. Now, the gentleman with him was also carrying a concealed weapon, but he was not wearing a shirt by the same company as my son, so they never once asked him. Now, quite frankly, I would have asked him also because he's standing there with him, but he was told you either have to leave the premises or you have to go lock it back in your vehicle, which he did. But that's brings me to this part. So people are walking in, and there is no such thing as random, all right, unless you're saying we're pulling the third, you know, the third person each time. But beyond that, how can we pull people if we don't have a cause?
Because they're on our campuses, our school administrators have the ability to do random searches on campus. It's specific to our campuses. So your example for Disney Springs, if that were our campus, we would be allowed to do that search. But it's because it's on our campus.
I don't see it any differently than what we have here at the administrative center when people come to the board meetings. We have metal detectors, and when you pass through, we're screening for weapons and other contraband.
But we're screening everybody when they come here for board meetings now. We're not doing a random right. selection without cause. Go ahead.
Brennan?
So is your concern the word random?
No, my concern is that we have no cause to even suspect that they're doing anything wrong. And I think we're going to get into an issue where someone could claim discrimination because, like, well, you selected me because I'm of another ethnicity. Like, you only selected people of a certain ethnicity, or you only selected men, or you only selected me because, you know, my hair's purple and I have a nose ring. Or like my son, you've only selected me because I happen to be wearing a shirt that is sold by this company. But you don't select my buddy who's standing next to me, you know. And so that's what I'm down to. I mean, I want everybody to be safe, but This really opens us up, I feel, to someone to be able to say that we discriminated against them and selected them because of these reasons and that we weren't being open to everyone. You know, if we're going to do searches. Like, if we're going to put everybody through a metal detector to go to a thing, then we're treating everybody equally. That's where I'm at on this.
And the problem with having all campuses being protected with metal detectors is the cost factor. You know, we've looked at that. I know that Chief Newman brought that before the board some time ago. What this policy language does is allows you that flexibility to have random searches as a matter of your policy. It's stated. Certainly during one of the good things about this today is we're workshopping this language. So if there are amendments or changes that the board would like to see, Mr. Chairman, we're happy to incorporate those changes. But it's the recommend, as I understand it, the recommendation of our security team is that we have this language in to allow us to conduct these searches to preserve the safety and security of the campuses.
Ms. Burnett, you still have the floor.
Well, yeah, so I'm just sitting here trying to absorb all this, but it says visitors for one. It's not the students, right? This is visitors. Visitors, okay. So that would be people coming onto the campus to attend an event or to deliver product.
Yeah. All visitors would be anybody visiting campus. So whether you work here, you're not work here. If you're on our campus, we're allowed to search.
Okay. And I'm trying to think, like, when we go to concerts, our bags are checked. So how are we different? How are we the same?
On Florida campus, we're allowed to search. So, like, if you have a principal on your campus, principal can go through your locker, SOR cannot. So the principal has liberties, the administrators on campus have liberties that law enforcement do not. We're letting them know that we have these liberties. We do not have to have your permission. We don't have to have probable cause. We don't have to have all these levels of burdens. They're allowed to search, and that's the way it is now.
So we're allowed to do that now. We're just making sure everybody is aware that we're allowed to do it.
Thank you, Ms. Cuthbert.
It's always been posted. About this. My husband retired in 2004. I mean, he did random searches as an AP in charge of discipline and security. But a lot of times he did it with cause because he had someone tell him the fight's going to start or somebody had brass knuckles in a book bag. But still, at the same time, prom comes up and a lot of kids have bottles. Graduation, comes up and there are incidents. I mean, I remember a cabbage coming out from underneath a graduation gown. It was a joke for Mr. Henson, David Henson Sr., because of Cabbage Patch, but it could have been anything because nobody saw that cabbage when he was searched or patted down when he came in. It somehow, some way, it became apparent. So our students are becoming very, very clever in hiding and concealing weapons and everything. So I think we need to have that, but at the back of our mind, we shouldn't. I kind of agree with what Ms. Haynes says, but at the same time, we have to protect our other students as well, because sometimes the good kids are being coerced into doing things. But I think in the back of most administrators, they're going to do it because of a cause or a thought or a word or a posting on social media, and they do have to have that ability. So we appoint, the district appoints campus leaders with that in mind. They go through 2 years of training, correct, in order to be able to make those decisions. But it should be based on security and safety for the entire campus, because hindsight is always golden, but we never know ahead of time what's going to happen. It's not written on people's foreheads, I'm out here to do something. So it's very important, but at least the language should show that we have the ability to do it, whether or not they do it, and I don't think they're going to do it with just because they've got something better. They don't have anything better to do. They do have too much other things to do, but it should be based on the protection of the entire campus.
Thank you. Ms. Haynes?
So I come back to this piece because having been a teacher on campus, typically any time a student's backpack was searched was because there was cause, because the student themselves made a reference to having something in their backpack that then was told, and then there was a reason to search it. And you weren't going to have any parent or group saying that you had discriminated because, and now, you know, kids post things on social media, and we have a right to choose. I go back to that without cause and that you're doing random, and I really think, so here's what I want to know. Nowhere with this statement is there attached that there's any state legislation that supports this statement. Where there was in that last policy, when we looked at the attendance piece, you stated this. So is there any state legislation that supports us putting this statement in here that says they will be conducted at random and without cause? Because if you even look up above, it says only clear bags are allowed at after-school events, such as sporting events, graduations, or programs in the auditorium or cafeteria. And we just did graduations, and at graduations, we got an update that one of the schools, there were some things that were confiscated, you know, that came in. So I'm assuming we checked everybody's bag coming in for that school. If it's either we're going to check everybody and everybody's going to be treated the same is where I stand, or there's going to have to be, in my thought, there has to be a cause for why you're pulling that person. I just, this whole random and without cause, I think we're opening ourselves up for liability.
Ms. Burnett?
So I'm kind of going to your point. I was going to ask you if there was a state statute that we could reference here stating why we had this verbiage.
We can get you the statutory site for that authority.
And I think that we should have it in the policy.
And we're happy to put it in the policy. There is a section at the end of the policy that has the link, the statutory sites for all of the authority for those policies.
On the one previous, though, it stated it right where the statement was made. So if we're going to put a statement in and there is a policy that supports that from the state level, I'd like to see it. We can have that addendum piece, but, like, it's right there, and it says so that we know that that statement is supported by this piece of legislation.
I will tell you the theory behind why we don't put that in, because state statutes can change, and then we have to bring those policies back. And if they occur, if we're going to the spring and fall cycle, there's a delay in most statutes are going to be made effective July 1st, most legislative years. So it would necessitate us bringing the policy back for advertising and republishing and approval like we're doing today. So that is the theory behind why we don't. I'm happy to include it's this is the board's, as we always talk about, policy is the board's purview. This body, Mr. Chair, is responsible for the policies. We understand that as staff and make sure that that happens. So it is, we can put in here whatever the board's pleasure, but that is the theory behind not quoting statutes because they're subject to change and requiring the policy to be revised.
Ms. Burnett?
Are we notified when they change?
Yes, we have annual notifications. I attended a workshop Friday to go over legislative changes. I think the financial group meets. We have our lobbyists who provide us with the legislative overview of statutory changes. We're constantly doing that.
Follow up. I personally think that we should put it there, and that forces us to look at the policies and make sure that we're reviewing them on a frequent pattern as well. That's my opinion.
Noted. Ms. Cuthbert?
The worst thing that could happen to us is to look back and say we should have. I don't want any of our children to have to cower inside of classrooms. That is the worst thing. And I'm sure most schools would say it could never happen here, but sadly, tragically, too many schools said it did happen here. So let's look for a solution to make us still be safer. Maybe we should have a policy of all clear backpacks, even when they attend school. But then that also leads up to students hiding things in lockers. But aren't we, we're kind of in the middle of building new schools without lockers because they've become almost obsolete because everything you put, download your books and put it on a computer, and you don't need textbooks as much. So we're on the cusp of changing technology, changing procedures, living in a very dangerous society, especially when we don't have the mental health care. We do it in our district now, but where's the mental health care that are available to cities and counties? I don't see that happening. And most people who have those difficulties either have to go to a hospital, they have to be Baker-acted, or they just go under the radar until they are picked up by the police. Then the police have to deal with this issue. So what can we do to make our students safer? So maybe we should have a policy. We have to do it now so that all students coming to our schools have to have a clear backpack. That eliminates that search problem because it can be seen. Second of all, we may not need our lockers anymore. And just to either take them out or not use them, lock them up and not given anymore. My grandkids don't use their lockers. They don't even, because it's necessary anymore. So maybe we can do that. But also, we still need the ability to look at what's in there. Ms. Wiles used the word fidelity. And I don't think we would do searches without fidelity. So if the searches are done with fidelity in mind, random searches, but with fidelity, with responsibility for it, maybe that fidelity word needs to be in the language so that it's just not, oh, I think I'm going to go out and do that. But I don't think our safety and security personnel are going to go out and do it just for the heck of it. They have better things to do. So the language has to show that we're doing it for protection, but not willy-nilly, just because it's the thing to do. But I think they need that ability to protect our students. Does that word help with fidelity? Or instead of without cause, but with fidelity? I'm a language person. I'm trying to think of a better way to stay that maybe the with or without cause is an outdated term. But with fidelity and with maybe a suspicion, with in order to protect the general population, something else could be put into that. Sir, what do you suggest?
Chair, my only concern with putting in probable cause and suspicion is those are criminal terms.
Oh, okay.
And they don't necessarily apply on school campuses because going back to an earlier question, I'm reminded that school campuses are not public places. We are not a business inviting people to come onto our facility for our purposes. We are schools that are limited forum for our students, and we do have trespass laws, and we have security issues with our campuses. We don't just allow anyone to come on. We're not inviting the public to come on. It's not a public space. So when we're talking about putting in criminal terms into our policy, I would just caution against that. I'm happy to work with the board on changes to be made here, but it's my understanding that this is language that was suggested by our security team. And
Mr. Persis?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, well, I don't want to muddy the waters, but it's always been that the school principal administrator could search if they had a reasonable suspicion. Went on that basis. Now, law enforcement had a higher benchmark, probable cause, which school administrators didn't. And you need to go to that level. Now, that hasn't changed, correct?
Right.
Yeah. Right. So, trust me, the last thing that school administrators want to do is take the time to do any of this stuff. And when they have a reasonable suspicion, though, they need to know that they can act on it, as they've always done. I'm not at this point a proponent of the clear backpack. That's been tried in other districts and is not as successful as one would think. In fact, there's some school districts who are trying to unload thousands of clear backpacks now because something about privacy rights that the students have and so forth and so on. And your backpack may be in a violation of that. So lockers, yeah, I see lockers going bye-bye. I think students still will need to have some sort of a backpack to carry their personal things. Mr. Chair.
Yep. Mr. Chairman, that just for the board, I'll remind the board that we do have a current clear bag policy for events. So if you're coming on now, whether that's enforced with fidelity, I can't speak to, but I will say that it is in current language that clear bags for visitors coming onto campus for events is current policy.
Yeah, just like sporting events have.
Correct.
Yeah, that's pretty.
So here's where I struggle with this. First of all, we're saying that a site administrator can search a visitor. This is related to visitors. I don't know that I want to put our site administrators in the position to search a visitor, especially without cause. And so I am a little disappointed because this is not DOJ language. I thought a lot of these policies we were looking at involved DOJ language and the settlement, et cetera. The thought that we would say that we're just going to do random without cause, I have a problem with that. I think I don't know any adult that can walk up to another adult and say, empty out your pockets without being a police officer. And the job of our guardians is not to be police officers. So as far as I'm concerned, the only thing that I could live with is we already can search anybody we want if we have cause. So that's our current state. I could live without that sentence being in there. If we want to address this, then I would say with cause. But that then brings a definition of what is with cause. And so I can't imagine, other than having a police officer standing there, how we could say to another adult, empty out your pockets, or let me pat you down, or let me use a wand. I don't know how we can do that. I mean, we're talking about allowing site administrators, which the only site is, we're not talking about guardians, we're talking about the principal walking up to a parent and saying, let me wand your bag. I don't know how we could do that without cause. I don't know how we could justify. I mean, if you have cause, you're going to call the police, and I want them to continue to call the police. Not necessarily put themselves in a position where they are, I mean, because this, again, we can do it with students. Students is a non-issue. That has been constitutionally upheld. The courts have opined. I mean, I've done some research on that. With students, but this is addressing visitors. And so I don't want my administrators to have to conduct searches on anybody that's grown. I don't know why this is in here. So in any case, if there is a desire to, I could live with, again, saying with cause by site administrator. In other words, I have a reason to suspect. But if I have a reason to suspect, do you think that I really, as a principal, want to approach a parent and say, hey, empty out your pockets? Or I'm going to wand you because I think you may have a gun? That's not their place. So what I'm afraid of is we're going to put people in situations that they really should not be in. If you have a suspicion, call the police. I can't imagine any situation where we would. So that's where I am. I mean, we could talk about this later. We could revisit the policy. We could, you know, I don't know if you want a round robin of where we feel about this, because this is, I mean, we've got a lot of DOJ policies to go through, and we haven't even gotten past the first one, or we got past the first one. We're on the second one, and we're stuck on this that was thrown in there by safety and security, something that none of us have talked to anybody about other than what we learned at the DAC meeting. So as far as I'm concerned, like I said, that's kind of where I am. I can live without it. I don't even know why we're talking about this. If there's a reason to search somebody, call the police. We're talking about adults here. We're not talking about kids. Kids, we can do it. We know we can. And including the wand. So that's where I'm at. We can round robin real quick. Let's just go around real quick and see where we kind of are with a consensus. We'll start with you, Mr. Persis.
In regard to just this one item.
Just this one item here that we've been on forever.
Well, it's so hard to generalize it. It would be like, what is the situation? What if there was not a law enforcement person anywhere around and you became aware of a person in the parking lot that had a gun, and someone texted you and said, that guy I know has a gun, and he is wanting to come to the open house, and your law enforcement isn't around, and you become aware of this situation. So what would be a reasonable, prudent move for that principal to do? You have to be able to have that authority that say, sorry, because people with guns aren't supposed to be on school grounds anywhere. But I'm just saying there are certain situations, so you wouldn't want to put the principal or an assistant principal in the situation where that person did the wrong thing by stopping this person because of the fact that that the administrator had a reasonable suspicion to search that person, or at least stop that person. You know what I'm saying? I mean, it's granted, In the best case scenario, you would have your guardian there or a police officer and say, hey, I was just informed you need to do something about it. And that police officer would. I'm just saying, again, I think it depends on the level of the threat. Like, you know, what is the threat? If someone tells me parents out in the parking lot smoking pot, well, that doesn't rise to the level of he has a gun. You know what I'm saying? So I'm not saying that, you know, there are certain things that you certainly don't want on your campus, but how far that you would take it, it depends on what the level of the threat is. I'm just trying to be honest with you.
So you're good with leaving the language in with cause? Because what you described
suspicion,
is...
I don't know the word cause. I always think of probable cause, and right. That takes it higher in my mind now. Maybe.
Well, here we have, right now we have without cause, which so it's already in there.
I just don't want the principal, assistant principal, to feel like he or she doesn't have the backing of the board in preventing something from happening.
Gotcha.
Okay. So however we can wordsmith that, I agree with you.
So yeah. You're saying with cause. In other words, if they have a suspicion, they should be able to do it.
Have a suspicion, yes.
Okay. Ms. Cuthbert?
I'm trying to think of everything in a 360. We don't live in normal times anymore. There have been over 300 mass shootings. We have public, we live in a public world. I mean, anybody can walk into our front office. Quite a few years ago, I thought our clerks on the front desk should have hazard pay. I mean, remember me saying that, hazard pay, because they're the front lines. Anybody could walk in. And I mean, I know kids, you know, when New Smyrna High was built, it was built in a circle, much like Pine Ridge and Atlantic. But the kids still can put little door jabs in the door, so if you're going to skip, you can get back in. Kids call their schools prisons. You can leave any time. It's just you can't get in. This is probably one of the most soul-searching things we have to do. But we also have to plan for the worst-case scenario. We don't have to do the random searches. But I think if there is a reason for it, I think it'll come forward. We're not going to do this because it's a cool thing to do. We're doing it to help protect our public general population. Because it could happen. And so I think our policies are not something that we're going to do. It's not a procedure. It's not set in stone. But it also has to be something that could happen. Could happen. And just what Mr. Persis was saying, you can't let a kid go home because they're having a bad day anymore. That's against the law. It's against procedure, but we also have a duty to protect the worst-case scenario. I never, ever want to be on a board like Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School. They're still going through so much trauma, and it can happen anywhere. If it can happen in Uvalde, it can happen in Connecticut. It can happen here. We have to face the facts, and we have to bite off things we don't want, we don't like. But we have to give our safety and security team the possibility, the permission that it could happen. And I remember calling the police when I was at Indian River Elementary. It took them 20 minutes to show up. The Sheriff's Department says, not our duty, it was the city. So we have 16 cities, and a lot of them don't have time even to help us, except for Port Orange. I swear to goodness, Port Orange is on top of it to help our students get in and out of their campuses. So I think I agree with the way it is. Do I personally care for it? No. But does our school district need this to protect our kids? Yes.
Okay. Ms. Burnett?
Yeah, definitely something that I think there's two situations here. There's regular school and then there's after school, and I think that could kind of get clouded here as well. But I think the conducted random without cause is probably not the best wording, and it probably should be more for cause. And again, I think that there's two different situations that is going to require further direction or further conversation with this policy at a later time, too. Because, again, you have during school and you have after school events. And it's even blended into here some. So, but as far as this statement, I would prefer it say with cause and have the site, the state statute on there.
Thanks.
As I originally said, I think we're opening ourselves up with it saying random and without cause. Because currently on campus, our administrators have the ability to check if they believe that there is suspicion or cause. I don't know why we would move away from that, because that's been the way the policy has always been. And so, you know, I'm thinking if I'm an administrator and I do get that phone call, like you said, Mr. Persis, where they're saying there's someone in the parking lot that's going to come into open house that has a gun, that's a cause, okay? Now, quite frankly, I'm not so sure that I want one of our administrators to go out to that vehicle. I still think a phone call probably needs to be made if we don't have someone on campus that can handle, like, I think it should be a police officer or a sheriff's deputy or whatever handling that, or someone that has been trained in how to handle that appropriately. Because I don't want to lose an administrator who then, because I think we're putting, you know, we've all known as teachers or, you know, working on campuses in whatever job capacity, we've known that there's been a cause and those items have been checked and searched, all right? And there's been, but you're checking students, okay? It becomes a whole nother thing with adults. And I think we're opening ourselves up when we say random and without cause. We go back to there's some reason why they were randomly selected, unless you're seriously doing every third person that's lined up to come in. You know, that's random. But the moment you deviate from that, you're no longer at random, and you don't have, you know, it's either all or nothing, in my opinion. So I don't want to see it written this way. I'm fine with the way it's been written and how it's been handled on campuses, but I still would not want a principal to go out to a person's vehicle to say, you know, I'm not going to let you in if you have a gun. I think we're putting them in jeopardy, too.
So I have a question for the attorneys in the room. Does a site administrator, because the only administrator on site is a principal and an assistant principal, do they even have what it takes to be able to tell a grown person, I'm going to search you? I don't know. I'm having a hard time with that, because it's saying site administrator. God forbid we have our guardians do it, because that just makes things even rougher, because they're seen as police officers and they're also armed. So the only site administrator is really the principals and assistant principals. Do they even have the ability to walk up to somebody and say, I'm going to search your bags?
Are you talking about, do they have the training to do it or the good judgment to do it? Or,
I mean,
you could provide all that.
All of the above.
All the above.
Because if that's the case, then, you know, if we're talking about, so the way this is worded is not that the guardians or that the safety and security is going to do it. This is saying the site administrator.
Well, do you want me to answer that?
So that's where I'm struggling. I don't know.
I mean, I think that if you're going to have site administrators conducting searches of individuals, there should be some sort of training that goes with that, some sort of, you know, provided by the security maybe.
So as I read this policy, and to answer your question, what I think this is authorizing is the authority in the site administrator to delegate that to the appropriate personnel to conduct. Not that the principal has to go out personally with a wind. It's the by the fiat, the power of the policy, allows that search to occur on campus randomly and without cause. That's the way I read it. Not that the principal, him or herself, needs to be trained to do the actual search.
So it reads, notice that searches may be conducted at random and without cause by the site administrator.
I would take out by the site administrator if that's a concern.
If you have the power to delegate, then you have the power to do it yourself.
Of course.
So,
but I understood the question. It was, does the principal have the training to do it, yeah, or are we concerned about the safety of the principal, him or herself? This is policy language. So that's the way I would interpret that.
I mean, from the bottom line to this, and I heard somebody say, and I think it was Ms. Haynes, this isn't the way we've done it in the past. Well, have we had kids mowed down in the past? Thankfully not. Do we have them mowed down with AR-15s presently? Yes, we do. So in my mind, I don't care what the adults, how they feel about being searched, not searched. I got a backpack right here. You want to go through it? You're welcome to go through it right this minute. I don't deserve to be on this campus. If I think I've got anything with me that in any way can't be seen by you, knowing that there are children in my presence, it's as simple as that. I mean, I understand the sensitivity to it, and this is what you're trying to wrestle with. But I understand the sensitivity to it, but, you know, it's a balancing act. And on the one side, you got kids being killed, murdered, slaughtered, can't even be identified after somebody has walked in a room and shot them to literally pieces, versus any adult that comes onto our campus, visitor in any way, shape, or form, whatever rights they have, I think they should be notified of that. If you come on this campus, you are subject to search, you are subject to, you know, whatever these things are, tell them in advance. I get that. I mean, I don't think we should just be randomly going out and grabbing people up and surprising them with some sort of search. But, you know, any adult deserve to be on our campus that is not willing to disclose whatever possessions they have on them in the name of making sure that all of our kids are safe? Now, then the question becomes, who can conduct those searches? A lot of people have a lot of levels of judgment. And I think, and I guarantee you there are some people that you would delegate, that you would say can do this, have great judgment, and will be flawless in their approach and do this without problems. Then you're going to have other people that, you know, aren't going to exercise the best judgment. I don't know how you mitigate that unless you tailor it to specific individuals by title, and I don't mean by name, and or provide them some sort of, you know, training or guidelines about how to approach this and what to do. And it just gets back to, you know, is that a pain? Absolutely, it's a pain. But, you know, as Ms. Cuthbert says, does anybody want to be sitting here knowing that, you know, you didn't, and in terms of restricting the cause or no cause, I think that people can apply cause if they choose to, but cause is a legal term, and it's not easy to define. And does it mean, you know, if you see a bulge in somebody, is that cause? Or does it, you know, what does it require before we're in a position to approach an adult and say, I'm not comfortable with you right now, can you let me see what you've got, you know, or what's going on? By saying no cause, what you're saying is that we are not ever in a position where we have to try and explain why we did it or defend why we did it. When an adult, one of our employees approaches a visitor and says, can I, you know, I'm not comfortable with you right now, can I just ask you to give me some, you know, some access to what you're carrying, or open your jacket, or whatever. Look, it's not easy. I get it. And there's nothing, you know, comfortable about asking another adult to provide that kind of information. And in the real world out there, everywhere other than on school campuses, they don't have to provide that information, you know, but on school campuses, if we ask them for it, they do. So it's, again, just lastly, striking that balance. And to what degree do you want to give guidelines, training, and or not to the people who are designated to perform these services? Again, that gets back to policy setting. That's my view.
And so I agree with you, and I think those are the questions that we don't have answered here in order to enact this policy right now. There's big gaps here, and the how matters just as much, and so that's my thought on that. And, you know, again, we do have to keep going because we've got lots of policies to review, but that's kind of where I'm, Ms. Burnett.
Excuse me. I was just thinking back to some of the comments that have been made. I don't think anybody wants anyone to come onto any campus and do anything wrong. The wording is where this is. Maybe we say everyone is going to be searched. Then there's no random, and there's nothing pinpointed to anyone. It's everyone who comes to the front office. You have to open your bag for us. Instead of the word random, and I think that's what some other people were pointing out.
Yeah, I mean, please, I'm not suggesting that anybody's acting in bad faith or that anything you've said is wrong. I mean, it's all right. It's just a function of balancing. Do you balance? To what degree do you take children's safety and balance it against the rights or privacy of adults who choose to come onto our campuses? That is what you're doing. And there's no right answer. There's no wrong answer. There is a right answer. It's the one you choose. There's no wrong answer to that. Now, I'm not sure by your statement. I want to make sure I'm clear. I'm not suggesting anybody wants anything to happen. But, when you get to the question of randomness, if you want to do everybody, that's one thing. But we all know, practically speaking, that's not going to happen. I mean, there's just no way that's going to happen. So if you everybody. So, when it comes back to randomness, if the law allows for it, why not give the latitude for it? It's as simple as that. I mean, if somebody wants to be, you leave these rights, these constitutional rights as adults, you leave them at the gate when you walk in. And when I was a kid, this wouldn't have even been a conversation. Nobody does anything as horrible as we've seen, but we now know it's different. And so that's why you're forced to grapple with this.
Can we just say, sir, do you mind if I say, that anyone coming onto campus is subject to search?
Is that what
we have now? And not even say with or without cause.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
So if you look at the back, so this is under the backpack section. What I would propose and what I hear the board somewhat coming to consensus toward is a sentence that says all individuals entering a Volusia County school site or event may be searched.
Period.
Would that suffice?
But then I go to the how.
Well, then in that case, we could...
Is that the coach who's at the football field who wants to search, who's the site administrator at that... And so going back to Ted's point, the how is... Yes, ma'am. No, please.
I think the how comes in when we have our security team come up and talk about procedures and how we implement the policy that you set. I don't know that the details of the how go into this, but I do think that comes into play when we do what we have scheduled in July, where we go through that detailed security plan. But I just want to say, like, back to the point as an administrator, I can speak, I know, for our principals when I say, like, what keeps us up at night is that when we're in charge of a school with 600-plus students, and we're acting as those students' parents. No, do we want to? What this policy does is it sets in to motion whether there's a policy in there about searches or not. And I recognize, just like Mr. Doran said, the balance between safety and
privacy.
I can totally see both sides. What the question is there wording and policy? As a principal, I'm going to do what it takes to protect my students. Whether what policy says or not, that I would do what it takes to protect the students, and all of our principals would. So then it's just a matter of is it in here and how is it worded? But I think that comes down to procedures and how staff implements it, and that's what we would present.
Mr. Chair, I think that's a great approach, because then what you're saying is everybody's subject to being searched, but the superintendent is responsible for establishing the how, as you put it.
But is that different than today?
Yes.
Everyone is subject to search, aren't they, on our campuses?
They are, but it's not formalized in policy.
And what we're trying to do here is formalize policy. If the chair will consider, my language would recommend would read, striking the underlying provision of the last sentence of backpacks, a new paragraph, all individuals entering Volusia County school sites or events may be subject to search pursuant to established procedures. Such search may be conducted by the use of an electronic device.
I'm in agreement with Mr. Penley.
All right. Go around. Ms. Burnett?
I could live with that.
Haynes?
I'd actually like two things.
Okay.
I'd like for it to be posted on all of our campuses and in multiple locations, along with in the policy, and I like it being a separate paragraph, you know, away from backpacks, but maybe, you know, a statement that says, the following items are not allowed on any Volusia County campus. You know, I know you have it later, like, you know, the guns and tasers and all of that, but I really think these two things go hand in hand, okay? Because the reason why we're going to search someone is because we are trying to keep these items off of campuses. We're trying to keep guns and knives and tasers and alcohol and
cabbage.
You know, huh?
Cabbage.
No, you know, and let's be honest, let's put vaping devices in there, because I'm over the vaping devices, okay? Because I don't think vaping devices are supposed to be allowed, but I think there needs to be two things. These items are not allowed on our campuses, all right? And then the new statement that you just read, I could live with, but I think they go hand in hand, and I think they need to be posted. I think they need to be in the student code, you know where we ask students to sign, you know, that you and parents have to sign. And I think there needs to be, you know, a visitor one, because if you're going to sign out to be a volunteer or whatever, I think you need to sign a statement stating that you know these items are prohibited from our campuses, and by signing this, you are stating you will not be bringing these items on campus. And when you look at a football field, wherever the entrance is for a football field, I think there needs to be a metal sign there that says these items are prohibited and cannot be brought into the football field. And then here's our statement about searching. And I think if we do that, then I think we are as covered as we can be. Because really it comes back to that whole random and, you know, who's going to do the search or anything. But if we list there and we have told you, these items are not, because I got news for you. I mean, 9 times out of 10, they're not carrying a gun in the backpack. They've got it somewhere on themselves, and searching a backpack, still not producing the gun or wherever they hid the cabbage. The cabbage wasn't in a backpack. Let's be honest. And so I think we need to be very clear on these are the prohibited items. Anything we want to prohibit, it does not belong on campus. And everyone's open to, or school events. That's where I'm at on it. I think it needs to be just a separate section, but that's Jamie's opinion.
Mr. Chair, I would just remind the board, this is the student code of conduct for elementary 208E and student code of conduct for secondary 208S. It's my understanding that these code of conduct are sent home annually with the students, and they are signed by the student and the parent and returned to school.
But we put this visitor piece under the kid backpack thing. I mean, it maybe needs to be
its own section.
We'll make it its own paragraph. What I would propose to do is to strike the current last two sentences, the backpack paragraph, and have a new paragraph that is searches, underlined, and then the language that we discussed, and we can reference those items that are contraband in the subsequent. It's my understanding that they're outlined later in the student code of conduct policy itself. We can cross-reference there.
Ms. Cuthbert, any thoughts on Mr. Pendley's suggestion?
I'm in total agreement. Yes, thank you.
Mr. Persis?
Yeah, I'm all in on that, but I do agree that we need to let everyone know what the policy is.
All right, sounds like we have consensus.
And as we post this, it should be a certain color, not just white background with black lettering, because most people just gloss over it. If it's a bright color, I think in the past it's been a red color, but something that's noticeable. I just thought I'd say that.
All right, very good. So we will move on to, did we finish this one?
So there's more in 208. Is that what we're ready for? So if you go to,
Mr. Chair, if I might, just let me remind the board. So procedurally, we are taking these to workshop, and this has been extremely beneficial, and I think we all see the added value to having this discussion. But we do need to get these, because of the timing of the settlement agreement, we need to have these published so that they can be adopted before July 31st. So I would just remind the chair and the board that we are under time constraint here to get these everything that DOJ has asked us.
Are you able to bring this back this evening revised for approval?
Yeah, we will revise them as we go through. But that's our goal here tonight or today is to get these approved for publishing tonight and then bring them back for adoption before July 31st.
Thanks.
So with that, we still have one more meeting this month that if any of this needed to go to that one, we could still make the deadline because of the date of our meeting in July.
I think we only have one meeting in July is the problem.
Right, but say you need a little bit more time on this one because this one's got, okay. We could still bring that back to the next June meeting and agree to advertise and still make it in time because we're going to vote on these at the July meeting, right? All of these, because we don't have enough time between this meeting and the next June meeting to vote.
Typically, the way this works is we approve for publication, we publish them 28 days, and then the next full month cycle board meeting is when we bring them back. We would not be bringing them back for the June 28th meeting, but I'm not sure that we have another meeting in July that would allow us to bring something June 28th and still make our publication without calling a special meeting.
The meeting is July 26th.
That would not do it. I can tell you that if we bring something on the 28th of June, we would not have 28 days of publication.
Okay. All right. That was my question.
Without a special meeting. Now, it's always the board's prerogative to bring back on July 31st, if we're, you know, whenever that 28th day falls, we have done that in the past for other emergency rules and policies. I'm not encouraging the board to do that, just as an option.
Well, and right now we're just voting to advertise. And so as long as we don't make any substantive changes at the time of approval, there is a little bit of room there, little bit, very little. So, and during that time, I'm very curious to hear the how, because again, what's important to me is that we don't create a bunch of G.I. Joes versus we're still calling the police when the police needs to be called, and that we're not creating this, you know, situation that may put somebody in a really bad situation where they do confront somebody because they can and they get shot. So that's my concern, but we'll bring that back. All right, let's keep going.
Okay, so Roman numeral 2A, 21, it's the definition of exclusionary discipline.
Where are you?
I'm on 7, yep.
Any objection to the language? This is getting back to the DOJ stuff, so.
Correct.
On page 9, paragraph 40, informal removals.
I have no objection. Anybody else? Any changes to this?
May I ask a question,
sure.
Ms. Hazel? Is Saturday school still operating at the high school level?
Dr. Berry, we have Saturday boot camps. Are you talking as a punitive consequence?
Yes. If kids don't show up to suspensions, in the past, there's been Saturday school.
I'm looking at Dr. Berrio. I don't believe it's not. I know we have Saturday boot camps, but they're for study purposes and not as a consequence. We do not have Saturday schools as a consequence.
Okay, because Saturday school's in this policy. So it's a possibility that we could.
Like that.
Yeah, I haven't heard about Saturday schools.
Dr. Berry, are you wanting? You can come up.
Hello, everyone. Okay, so yeah, so there are different options, and so the way they look at the way the different schools look at Saturday school is like an alternative to detention. So you have detentions during the week, and then you also have detention on Saturday. So technically,
you have Saturday school,
yeah. So there is Saturday school, yeah. So there's two different things. There's Saturday school for behavior, and then there's Saturday school for boot camps, and the school's prerogative in terms of how they do it.
Okay, so it's in the policy, so it's an option.
It is option, not right, correct.
Correct.
And that's what I'm hearing, not every school.
All right, very good.
Right. Thank you.
Any objections to 40?
Later on that page, 46 gives a definition of multi-tier system of supports, which is the new intervention process that we're going to be following.
Questions? All right.
Next page, 10, number 56. Qualified individual with disability, student with disability definition.
And just to clarify, the purpose of this is to clarify that this is in compliance with ADA Title II.
Right. These changes are just the substantive ones that DOJ worked with me back and forth on. On page 11, number 67, the second sentence.
That is what I was referring to earlier.
Okay, so
you said it was long-term or short-term.
So if we're doing a short-term, a timeout, and it's not in the student's IEP but it needs to happen, we need to make sure we're documenting that so that we can better support a student and modify their IEP or BIP, or if they don't have either plan and this is a new novel thing, then it would come into Child Find and we would need to realize that we need to better support them. Some of the problems that you had identified were because we didn't have the documentation that we were supporting the student, so we can't punish the student unless we're supporting the student. So that's where the circular thing came out. But as long as we can work towards accurately supporting the student, whether it's following the plan or making sure that we modify the plan to implement more support systems, then we are good to go.
Thank you.
Keep going.
On page 12, we have C2. It's the paragraph that starts, a student with a disability who is.
Page 12? 13. Okay.
Oh. Are the page numbers off? I'm sorry. I'm not going to use page numbers anymore then.
Any questions, thoughts, feelings, or concerns? All right, we'll keep going.
paragraph C3, the last sentence, refers and incorporates to board docs. So we just put a bunch of reference cross-referencing in so that people know where to get the full policy.
Cool. All right. Keep going.
Number 4, C4, is a paragraph adding the importance of proactive interventions and documenting interventions and outcomes. And again, this just goes back to making sure that we are supporting the student.
I think Ms. Wiles spoke to this already, and of course everything's dependent on implementation.
That all teachers, ESE as well as mainstream, so
correct.
That needs to be, every teacher needs a copy of that.
Correct.
We need to add the word all in front of that. English teacher?
I would think so. All teachers are expected to utilize proactive strategies.
Perfect. I'll add it.
Objection to that? Okay.
Paragraph 8, the decision to involve law enforcement officials is a cross-reference to 510, which we'll go over in a little bit.
All right.
D5. Cross-references to the transportation policy on board docs.
Questions? All right, we'll keep going.
7 is a cross-reference back to Title II of the ADA, Section 504, and IDEA.
Questions? All right, keep going.
It's my page number 17, so let me get it for you. It is? Okay. So the note that says where a disciplinary infraction is committed by a student with a disability, that just makes it is a cross-reference back to Title II. That note is made again at the end of the next section on my page 18 and again on page 21. It's the same exact cross-reference back to Title II, 504, and IDEA.
Anybody? All right, we'll keep going.
Okay. Roman numeral 3, B2, is a cross-reference to 510, which is safety and security policy on board docs. Paragraph 3 is a cross-reference to 504, which is the transportation policy on board docs.
All right.
4 includes a cross-reference to 504 and Florida Statute 300-510.
Regulatory, we're good.
3, where am I? I got lost all of a sudden, sorry. B5 is a cross-reference to Title II, 504, and IDEA.
Okay.
Going too fast, just let me know.
Yep, you're good.
Okay. The bullet in E1 is a cross-reference to Title II, 504, and IDEA.
Okay.
Roman numeral 4 adds additional requirements, procedures for students with disabilities. 4.3 is a cross-reference to... is a cross-reference to 504, Rule 6A5.3312.
Okay.
4 is a cross-reference to the general rule.
Okay.
Section B updates some of the terminology used.
Okay.
Section C adds the reasonable modifications, which is required by Title II, and it was a big part of the settlement agreement. As was Section D, which is the manifestation of a disability.
All this is regulatory, correct?
Yes.
Okay.
And then that last paragraph there is, again, another reference back to board docs to make sure that everybody understands that we're incorporating everything into this document. We're just not fully transposing the transportation and safety and security into this document.
All right. Any thoughts, feelings, or concerns before we move on to the next one? All right, we'll go on to the next one. Do we need a bio break, or are you guys good? All right, we'll keep going.
Can I add one statement?
Yes.
So as we went through these, we saw where state statutes were referenced.
Yes.
So I still go back to that very beginning part where,
yes.
So in that new section you're doing, I'd like the state statute okay. referenced there too. So I mean, because I heard, Kevin, what you said about it being at the end, but it's throughout this document on other pieces, so.
Chair, if I may, that we made those same arguments to the Department of Justice lawyers. They wanted these cross-references in, even though we already have them, and most of them are either statutory or already in Florida Department of Education rules and regulations anyway, which we have to abide by, but it makes Washington happy, so we're all about making Washington happy in this rule. I would happily tell them that, yes, absolutely.
That is a good
thing. Let me just see if I can speed this up. That's all of E, so 208E, Student Code of Conduct. The same changes, and I'll just ask Ms. Harrigan to give you a highlight of those, the distinctions in the secondary Student Code of Conduct, 208S, that has the same cross-references, the same regulatory compliance pieces. So if we could just highlight how those changes were made for the secondary students as opposed to elementary.
Sure. So Roman numeral 2A, 40 in elementary is 41 in secondary. Instead of being 46, it's 47. Instead of being 56, it's 57. Instead of being 67, it's 68. So it's really just there's extra stuff in the secondary policy. It moves some of the paragraphs around. Substantively, it's the same changes.
Or do we want the same changes to reflect in the secondary policy that we discussed in the primary one? Okay, very good.
Okay, next policy.
Hold on, let me just scroll real quick, make sure everything is a cross-reference. Sorry. You can go on.
Okay, 216 is students with communicable diseases. Addition is paragraph 4, which is
Hold
a non-discrimination
on.
Paragraph.
216.
Okay. Yes, if yours is longer than just four paragraphs, please know that the other section was all struck except for, I believe it's paragraph E in the longer version.
Oh, we have four paragraphs.
Okay,
right
perfect.
Now.
So then that's the one.
Four ducks.
That's the right one. So paragraph 4 is the new paragraph. It's just a non-discrimination paragraph.
Changed from.
Okay, so if you're seeing a longer version, everything came out except for paragraph E.
There was a longer version when I went through it and took notes.
Yeah. Perfect. Yes, disregard them all.
Yeah, I was looking over the weekend, and this is
Sorry
not
Sorry about that.
One.
We okay. I've been trying really hard to work with DOJ, and some of it just came back very recently. So
okay.
Some of it is changing on the fly, and I do apologize for that.
The substantive change, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, the substantive change here is to simply add that cross-reference of non-discrimination in paragraph E. Otherwise, the policy remains as it stands currently for communicable diseases.
Correct.
All right, thank you.
Does that answer everybody's question?
Okay. Is that the one that had the mask thing in it and
yes.
all that? Okay, let's keep going. Done. Thank you.
All right. Student dress code, is that 217?
Which one's that?
1905.
Thanks, Ms. Jamie.
And that is to add Roman numeral 3, reasonable modifications. I can't give you an example of what that would be, but DOJ required that it be in there. A shoe policy and someone's in a cast, they will not be required to wear two shoes. I don't know.
Or in a walking boot that or whatever.
Makes sense.
Correct.
Or good.
Good? All right.
I just wish people followed this policy.
That I can't help you with.
Oh, I have some thoughts, but I'm not even going
there. 315 is field trips.
Hold on. 11?
Yes, that is item 19.11 in your action items.
And we added Roman numeral 10, which is students with disabilities.
Is the gist of this that they'll be able to participate and we don't have to make their parent come?
Correct.
And so if the school has a field trip and the student and the parent would like that student to participate, we will make all the accommodations for that student to be able to
correct.
Participate, correct?
And it just includes, you know, let the equity officer know if you need a certain accommodation or let the transportation know if you need a certain kind of, it's just a notice procedure, but you're allowed to participate unless there's a major change in
our... I'd be curious to hear the how on that, too, later on. How the schools would communicate that accordingly, and so that we don't end up having an issue because somebody didn't know that they needed to do whatever that is. All right. Ms. Haynes?
This brings up one other thing, and it's not about the field trip piece, but it's about the before and after school care, because that's where we have heard the most complaints, is when we have a student that spends the day on campus with a disability or something, and then they're told that they can't, though, come to before or after school care. And so if we're going to allow them to go on a field trip and do whatever accommodations, I think we need the same thing in before and after school care. I don't see that if a child's spending the day on campus that we deny that. If we're making the adjustments, we need to make the adjustments all the time.
And we do. I was made aware of one concern this year, and it was a miscommunication that they just weren't speaking with the right people. That's absolutely the rule. You are 100% allowed to participate. Yep.
All right.
504 is transportation.
Chair, for reference, that is action item number 1908.
I do want to look in the back of the room. Transportation, we're good? You're waving in support? All right.
I did go out and spend the day with them.
Did they take you for a ride?
They took me to lunch.
Oh, there you go. In a school bus? No.
And the substantive changes?
Roman numeral 2, C1. We're just incorporating the school bus driver and the attendant into our MTSS team, the part that, you know, documenting and getting back to and communicating whether we need more supports or we need a removal or whatever we need, making sure that they're part of our team and involved in the process. There are some strike-throughs. I don't know if you want me to cover those. I was mostly going into the additions. Is that...
So why would we be striking through the fact that request for transportation because of a unique circumstances may be submitted? Because I've had situations in my district where we've been able to accommodate someone. And so that's, I'm on D1. And then the part of for unique transportation shall be reviewed by school board's designee, the superintendent, who will, and so that there you're talking about traffic safety, local police and sheriff's department. Of course, in my district, that's become an issue, so I'm not sure why we would strike that.
The reason that we're striking those is because we have to figure it out.
Huh?
So we're not allowed to deny transportation because you're on a blind curve. We have to figure out how to make it safe and then make sure that it happens.
Right. So, but this is all student transportation.
Correct.
So this isn't specific just to ESE. So
what it says now is requested transportation within the 2-mile limit does not qualify for hazardous transportation as defined in Florida statute, may be provided to students who require it via their IEP.
Right, but then we take away, I'll give you an example. We had a situation with a young lady whose parents both worked, and we were able to accommodate because just one street up from her house, there was a bus stop. And there was space on the bus. And so I don't know that getting rid of the mechanism and policy that would allow a principal to at least put in a request. It's not that we're going to say yes, but if we get rid of that altogether, then there is no mechanism for a human to look at the situation and decide, you know, if both of your parents are in the hospital and you need to get to school and you're living with your older brother or sister who can't get you there, I just don't see why we would take away this whole mechanism.
I think what she's trying to say is that we have to provide transportation unless it goes against the state statute. So instead of having all these details of, like, how we're going to do it, I think that's what they were taking out. But my thought would be when you look at D, where it says request for transportation within the 2-mile limit, which does not qualify for hazardous condition transportation as defined by the Florida statute or state board of education rule, may be provided though still to students when required pursuant to the student's IEP. So number one, I think there could just be a little bit added to that phrase, because we know that the state law says that if they are under the 2-mile, they don't qualify. But we also know the way they can qualify is if there's a hazardous condition, okay? And they're just making sure, though, that if a student has an IEP, because what if the child is only, 1.5 miles away, but they're in a wheelchair, okay? And that really would not allow them to be able to get themselves, the wheelchair may not be able to transport. So they're saying that this would include them. So I could read it as may be provided to students when required pursuant to the student's IEP or a specific document in need, because then we have the parents are in the hospital and can't provide transportation or something. And then you don't have to have all these how we're doing it. They're removing all the steps because we're just going to have to do it.
Right. So what I'm seeing here, though, is this is giving protection only to students with IEPs and taking it away from other situations.
It's not in the aspect that it's still if there's a hazardous condition. So if they're having to cross a major highway that's under the 2-mile, that's a hazardous condition. So we still take that into account.
But what if they don't have an IEP? Because here it says...
No. The state law says that we don't have to provide it if they're under 2 miles unless it's a hazardous condition. So anybody that's under 2 miles where there's a hazardous condition, they don't even have to have an IEP to qualify, all right?
Right.
Is that how you all are reading it then?
I read it just like you read it. You're saying that it's only for students with IEPs.
So requested transportation within 2-mile limit, which does not qualify for hazardous conditions transportation as defined by the Florida statute or state board of education rule, may be provided to students when required pursuant to the student's IEP. And so my point is that this number one says a request can be made if there are unique situations can be submitted by the principal who shall transmit the request to the director of transportation. So we're stripping that ability of even considering any other student who's not in an IEP or in a hazardous area. And again, I know situations that we've been able to accommodate where, and I'll say this out loud, there may have been a parent who has shared custody and we only pick up one address and not the other, yet we have an empty bus at the corner of where the mom lives, and
be very careful about courtesy busing stops and obligating us to courtesy. But I do think, to your point, possibly something that says that exceptions are granted on at the discretion of whomever, transportation right, so is, director.
And that's how we do it now. So that's why I'm saying striking number one, I think there should be.
And I think it's like any contract. If it's not specifically stated, then it is up. But I would if maybe some exception language, I guess.
Because the criteria is from the director of transportation services. We're not even getting into the criteria. We're just saying if a principal has a request, they can make the request.
Chair, if you will allow a friendly recommendation.
Please, please.
What I would suggest, and the reason for taking out paragraphs 1, 2, 3 are they're operational and procedural. So what I would suggest that we do to alleviate the concern is after IEP in the last sentence of section D, add or other documented exception.
What I was saying.
Okay.
Because we already have to give it if it's a hazardous area right. to everybody. But then. Okay.
So that leaves them, and the how will then become they request a transportation.
Correct. We're not getting rid of those. Actually, just policy is not a contract. Right. So it's simply an authorization. Then you have specific procedures and operational things that the superintendent does under the day-to-day operations that don't have to be spelled out verbatim in policy.
Good. So I'm good with that language. Any objection to adding that? All right, we'll move on.
Paragraph Roman numeral 3J, 4, and 5, just add safety language that wasn't written down. We do both of them. We just didn't have them written down.
Okay.
And then Roman numeral 7 is transportation of students with disabilities. And this is required by settlement. It aligns with Title II.
Objection? We'll keep going.
I thought it, this one was well done. It was very well
done. I had help. 507 is non-discrimination educational equity, which is 9. All that does is add some Title II language and the role of the ADA compliance officer.
Questions, thoughts, feelings, or concerns? All right. Looks good. We'll move on.
508 is the grievance procedure. That is
1906.
Six, yes. Thank you. And that adds Roman numeral 4, which is the the complaint procedure that y'all already agreed to. We just put it into the grievance procedure as an extra step. It's posted on the website already, and the form is active for filing a complaint.
We were required, Mr. Chair, if you'll recall, to do that within 30 days of the settlement agreement. So that was adopted early on, and we've been following that since.
Good. Anybody? Questions, thoughts? All right, we'll keep going.
509 is the prohibition of harassment, and that is
1907.
Got a little loose with the ordering of the action items. I apologize. These were done as they came in, and we were clear from Washington to put them in.
Yeah. Let's see here. Adds Roman numeral 3B3. And this adds a distinction between the ADA compliance officer and the equity officer. Roman numeral 7 is other remedies. That if you don't follow our procedure, you can still get resolution.
Thoughts, feelings, concerns? All right, we'll keep going.
Okay, 510 is safety and security, and that 1914, thank you. The first change is the last sentence in the first paragraph, and it makes this whole statute align with Rule 6A-1.0018 of the Florida Code. And then we have Roman numeral 2F sets out the role of the law enforcement officer, SRD, SRO, and when they become involved. It's a large part of the settlement agreement.
Thoughts, feelings, concerns on this one? We will move on.
And then we have 2H, which requires that the guardians also adhere to the policy.
Okay.
Roman numeral 4 is additional trainings that are required by DOJ. Yes.
That I had a question about. So
if you have the LGBTQ one, that's been stricken.
No, I know. Well, because we need a safe. We have to. We've always had safe spaces for children for a variety of reasons. No, I just wanted to make sure out of the ones that are still here. So this is what is being recommended. And is there a plan for how all of these trainings will be, you know, conducted and a time frame in which they'll be conducted, and how? If we bring in new people mid-year, like, how we'll know that they've received those? Because they do, I mean, I told somebody the other day, I've been in a situation where a four-year-old basically flipped tables through chairs and everything else, and yes, the police were called, but we were just doing our best just to make sure the child did not harm themselves and didn't harm anyone else. And once we had the child contained within a classroom, we just stood at the doors, you know, and allowed that child to flip the tables and throw the things and all of that, because you don't step in. And when the police arrived, they were like, well, it's a four-year-old. And the police officer decided to go under the table with the child, and the child bit his arm, you know. And I had said to him very calmly, he's not finished yet. You need to wait. Nope, it's a four-year-old. No problem. So I'm all for this, because they don't understand when our children go into a meltdown situation that you can't just, because they're a four-year-old, you know, you're going to get hurt too. So I just want to know that there's a plan for that piece. That's my question.
If I may, Mr. Chair, answer the question. Currently, with each new guardian class that comes through, there's extensive training before they are assigned to a school. That includes autism spectrum disorder. It includes training specifically on the requirements of the settlement agreement with the Department of Justice. It includes a full day of understanding behavior intervention plans. So there is a component currently for our new guardians. We've already trained. We're continuing to train on that. And, again, Ms. Wiles participates with the safety and security teams as necessary to update that training periodically.
Mr. Persis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just trying to think through what Jamie was saying with the four-year-old. So, yeah, so I guess the reasonable expectation is for the school personnel to de-escalate this and do everything possible. However, if, in fact, they cannot, then it would be an appropriate measure to have the law enforcement person there. But we just have to have proof that we went through all these steps first, or...
You don't have to prove it. It's
just have to do it. Just, we have to take that action first.
We're not stopping anybody from calling the police, for sure.
Right.
But this would be our policy.
Right. Yeah, but in other words, not call the police first, like right away. Like, you need to come down here. First, we got to do all the things that we're trained to do. Okay, great. And that's the training you'll be informing everyone. Good. That's all good. No, I agree.
Because we're still going to continue with the nonviolent crisis intervention training and certifying people in that. And I actually think there's a component of that training that almost every teacher needs. I know that we only send our ESE teachers and our coaches and administrators to nonviolent crisis intervention training, but the one thing that I see that happens, and it happens lots of times with brand new teachers, is they don't understand that if you back that child figuratively into a corner, you give them no other option than to come out at you. And that happens so many times, and that is why the behavior reaches this point. And when I talked about the four-year-old, you know, the child was new to an ESE classroom, and even though behaviors were noted and the ESE teacher knew, it was what happened at lunch that set that child off. And when they get set off at that point, that adrenaline kicks in, and they can do things that they normally, you would never think a four-year-old could do. I mean, he overturned a wheelbarrow that was full of dirt with, like, I wasn't sure that I could have done it, but his adrenaline kicked in. And the biggest thing was keeping him safe from being hurt. And 9 times out of 10, they run for the street. I mean, fortunately, we got him to run into a classroom door and then just close the classroom door. But, I mean, he was 4 years old and flipped tables and threw chairs and everything else. But I think sometimes, Ms. Wiles, if you're listening, a big component of teachers coming in should be about not pushing a child into a corner because they have no other way out. And that's when this behavior arises. And I think so many times that's missed. And I think it's something that just needs to be refreshed even every year for all teachers, that what you say to that child could figuratively push them into that corner. And it's, and you yourself are instigating that behavior then. It is.
It is. That's the best.
It's the best piece. I mean, because I held my
certificate. Teachers inevitably say the wrong thing and escalate it rather than de-escalate it. And then
I mean, I kept my certification for like 10 years just and went every year and renewed it because it's just that piece you have to stop and think about.
And to your point, it's not just teachers, assistant principals, even principals. We can all be guilty of saying the wrong thing that makes the situation
or the wrong look or getting
body into
their
language,
personal space.
I have a question. So on number 9, this is referring to SROs and SRD. Do we currently have this contract language in our contract with them where they're also agreeing that they will be trained in the, within the school setting as well as the rights of students prior to school assignment? Additionally, VCS security operations shall ensure that the local police chief and the county sheriff receive similar training. So, Sheriff Chitwood, if you're listening, receive similar training and be asked to disseminate it, so train the trainer, to their officers and deputies respectively. These trainings may include but are not limited to. So is that in our current language now, and do we provide that training? Are they learning it from us? Are they learning it asynchronous to us? How does that all look?
Chair, the current contracts with all the Sheriff's Department and all of the participating police departments is in conformity with this paragraph. We have worked very collaboratively with the Sheriff's Department and the police chiefs to include that language in the contracts. They understand the need for it and why we're doing it. We are providing training. I can't speak specifically to when that training was provided, but I know that they are receiving that, and they do participate with our school-based SROs and SRDs to receive that training.
And the next question is, what would be considered an assignment? So if I'm covering a school for a week and I'm normally a street officer, is that an assignment? Or, you know, again, I'm just curious, and that's the how. We could talk about that later. But, you know, it just seems like something that we would probably need to, because it's easy for us to talk about it, but, you know, when we request additional police officers to show up at a certain school and be on the campus, if 2 out of the 3 are not sensitive to these things.
Mr. Chair, we do have a protocol that the Sheriff's Department and the police departments have been advised. When they know that when they're reporting on campus to a call, they will be met by an administrator who will inform them. It's their responsibility to inform them of any positive behavior intervention plan, any circumstances that are particular to the student who might be involved, so that they know in advance, for example, that this is a student with ASD, with sensory issues, he's experiencing a crisis or meltdown. They would be advised of that upon arrival. Typically, we have 7 Sheriff's Department deputies who are assigned to our campuses. So those individuals are fairly are consistent. They know who they are. They the administrators on the campuses, those are high school campuses, I understand, have the same personnel. It's the rare occasion that someone would be assigned as a one-off without prior school knowledge. That typically does not happen unless someone gets sick or something like that. But we do have that procedure in place that if someone is a
patrol officers reporting to campus under circumstances they would be advised.
Awesome. Anybody else? All right, we'll keep going.
Next change is Roman numeral 10. It's the reporting of removals. I'm sorry, it's reporting of behavior-related interactions. And this is going to be aligning with the settlement agreement. It also aligns with the Florida Administrative Code. Much of this is already in play. We're already using CESAR. We're already monitoring the reports. We already are monitoring behaviors and patterns and stuff like that. So much of this is already in play, but this is the new language that we'll be asking that you approve.
Anybody have anything on this one? Keep going.
And the last part is just an appendix, and this comes from the settlement agreement, basically knowing the roles. A lot of it is repetitive from in the document, but we were asked to specifically include it here as well.
Any questions, thoughts, feelings, or concerns before we move on to the next policy? All right, we can keep going.
All right, the next one is 525. It's 1910, policy against bullying and harassment. The first change is on Roman numeral 4, about halfway down the page. It says infractions committed by students with disabilities. The cross-reference to the reasonable modifications, which is required under Title II.
Okay.
Then Roman numeral 5A. Is a distinction between the equity officer and the ADA compliance officer.
Okay.
That is it.
Those are all of the policy revisions that we're prepared to request tonight that the board approve for advertising.
Very good.
Good job.
All right, we'll take a 15-minute bio break, 10-minute bio break. Let's do 10, and we'll be back. It is 3:10.
You're welcome.
Superintendent Hazel.
Mr. Chair, at this time I'd like to call Stephanie Workman. Up to the dais. I'd also like to call Michelle Golden and Melissa Brown up to the dais. They are here to do a budget presentation. This is at a request, and it really is going to be a discussion facilitated with the board. They are going to present some information that you have. It's a very high-level overview of where our gains and losses have been as we've gotten the fourth calc and done some analysis. So we really want to go through that with you so you can see where it is. And then we are really looking to you all for some direction, and we're here to facilitate the conversation, to guide, to answer any questions that you have, but we're really looking to you for priorities.
Good afternoon. I'm Melissa Brown. Today we're going to touch base on some FEFP funding, ESSER funding, and the budget priorities. So the next few slides will show you a comparison between the fourth calc, which is the 21-22 budget current that came out late May, and it will compare to the first calc conference report, and that will be the budget we will build and use until the second calc comes out in July. Once that calc comes out, we'll do adjustments based on that and bring that to you for the July tentative budget. And I just wanted to highlight a few things. The base student allocation went up by $214.49, and that primarily went up for the $15 mandated minimum wage. That's to help offset that in all districts. The DCD, everybody knows about that, went down. So that just means that Volusia County is going to get $96.39 per dollar. so we won't get the whole dollar as other counties or more than that. And then the required local effort went up by 0.023.
So just to highlight that and add a few points to that, with the DCD going down, even though the required local effort went up, we don't realize all of that, the revenue that comes from that. Do you have any questions? Feel free. Yes, yes.
Thank you. So do we have an idea of the total dollar loss on the DCD that we're going to experience then?
That's, yeah.
Not at this moment. We can calculate that, bring that back to you at the tentative budget, or send that out in an email.
Please.
Thank you.
Ms. Cuthbert.
I figured that out myself. 0.25, and I multiplied it by 63,000 students. About $157.50.
That. Okay.
For the BSA.
Mm-hmm. Right. I'll do a little bit of a disclaimer to you. Our finance people work in exacts, so they're going to want to give you exact numbers.
Definitely.
Do they give justification why they lowered it? Because as far as I know, all the prices, everything's more expensive.
It is.
Not less.
They do not give justification. The only thing that we've, you know, they say we live in Volusia County. The beaches are pretty here. So other than that, they really don't give a justification on how that's, it's a calculation that we've been fighting for years.
Thanks.
So, to piggyback on what Ms. Cuthbert said, what I'd like to know is, when you have time, it's just a chart, you know, of where everybody was last year, because we were at the 0.9664, and where everybody is this year, so we can see who got the additional part they took away from us. I'd like to know who they are. And
who are the winners?
Yeah, who were the winners, you know, and what did their legislators, their representatives do to ensure that we went down.
We'll absolutely put that in the tentative budget presentation. Questions?
And just one other question.
Mr. Persis?
Chair, yeah, and the discretionary millage, the 0.748, that's the max that can be, and that's what it's always been as long as I can remember.
And the board can choose to do less, but we can't do any more. So.
Right. Right, and that money can be used for any purpose.
As discretion, yes.
Yes, good. Thank you.
All right. Ms. Haynes?
So, because I want to clarify something, because there's a lot of misinformation out there at times. And I, even though I thought Mr. Persis did a great job of explaining it when we were going over the budget last time and talking about how we as a board don't set that rate. You know, it's either we take what the state sets or we can go lower, but why would we ever go lower than what? Because the state keeps reducing us. I mean, if you look at, you know, we were at 8 point something and we're down to 5 point something. But unfortunately, the community thinks that we are like the county and that we can set our own rates, which we can't. And so then they're like, well, you raised our property taxes. And we're like, we didn't raise property taxes. And I really wish we could get that true story out to the world. Yes, and you keep trying, and you did a beautiful explanation. But, you know, that's, you know, people say it all the time, you raise our part. And I'm like, no, we voted on the budget that was presented to us because this much of it comes in sales tax, this much of it comes in federal and grants, and then this is the part that comes. And we're, you know, we're 3 percentage points on a millage down from where we were even a few years ago. Okay, so you may be paying more property taxes because let's look at what property values have gone to right now. And you chose to come in at this time and buy a house that, you know, 7 years ago you could have bought for $200,000 and you now just paid $750,000 for it. That's on you. That's not on us. But I really wish we could get that message out there, because I don't know about the rest of you, but I hear it all the time from people that, you know, we raised their property taxes.
Yeah, that's set from the state, and there's nothing we can do besides going lower.
Thank you.
Ms. Cuthbert?
And one thing a lot of people aren't thinking about is, as more people are moving here, many of them are retired, so they don't have a W-2 form. And our DCD, a lot of it depends upon the W-2 form, not where you live, but where you work. And so if a lot of retireds are coming in, they're not working. They make demands on our infrastructure and our economic development. However, it doesn't help us one bit. But they still use our kids, because it's our kids who are in the restaurants, in the grocery stores, and are really doing most of the service that they have come to demand in our communities. But unless somebody works in Volusia County and gets that W-2, we're not going to be able to have that income. So if it went down, maybe it's because we have fewer workers, and there are a lot of people who are not working right now, or they're working outside the county, or their checks are coming from outside the county. So isn't that correct? So it's all based on the W-2. If we could just change that to where you live instead of where you work, we would have that turnaround.
I think they've looked at those DCD studies through the years. There's been several of those in my 29 years in budget. There's been several DCD studies.
That's all as far as they go.
That is, yep.
All right.
So the next few slides are going to show you the winners and some of the losers, the decreases in funding from the fourth calc, which we just received this year, versus the conference, which is what we're going to build our budget on. And there's the base funding. That increase of $20 million is because, one, we increased FTE. So when your weighted FTE increases, your base student allocation, that increased to $214.49. All of that ties in. That $20 million has to go towards the $15 minimum wage requirement. It also has to go to cover FRS increases, staffing changes, such as the custodial expansion that we're doing, ESETOAs, formula changes and guidance. I'm just highlighting a few things, enrollment adjustments, as well as the priorities that we're going to discuss tonight. The next thing we have are the categoricals, and you'll see a lot of the categoricals are, some of them are up, some are down. They did phase out digital learning. That is no longer. Instructional materials did go down, just highlighting a couple of them. The next slide's just going to continue increases or decreases based on the category. You'll see the teacher salary enhancements, the $5.6 million. And then the class size adjustment, we have 1.3 increase. And then the total state funding increased based on all of those adjustments. The next one is the required local effort taxes, and that's going to increase. You can see the discretionary local increased as well, and that's based on your tax roll increase, which we all know home prices have increased, tax rolls increased, and the little millage increase that we got. So the total state and local funding is $34.2 million, and that's going to help fund the things that we discussed prior. Next is ESSER.
Excuse me.
Yes.
Mr. Person.
I'm sorry. I didn't put my name in the thing. Could you go back to the funding comprehension?
Compression.
I got reading on my brain, I guess.
yes.
Compression. You know, that was the way the legislature was trying to offset the decrease that we in other districts received with the DCD, and they added some money back. Now, obviously, it doesn't match how much that we lost. And I'm just wondering, so are we saying that we are getting less money? I'm trying to figure this out.
The funding compression?
Yeah.
It looks like it's a 4.6 increase from this current year. And what they're saying is the funding compression is if we are getting less based on our allocation than the state average, that's when they come in with that funding compression.
Right. And once again, let's say the DCD cost us
right
$10 million or 11, whatever it's going to turn out to be, then they add back in 4-6.
So that we get up to that state average.
So you're still short another $6 million right. at the least. Okay.
Yes.
Thank you. Just Absolutely. Wanted to clear that up. Yeah.
Ms. Cuthbert?
It's exactly what I was going to talk about.
Perfect.
So thank you.
Ms. Haynes?
Thank you.
So knowing that the increase to the base student allocation was really to try to offset the $15 per hour, not right now, but I think what I'd like to see before we come back in July, you know, to look at the budget is to know actually what the getting everybody to $15 per hour is going to cost us, because I know that the MOUs were signed and the notification went out yesterday and there appeared to be a lot of questions, you know, all over social media about it. But, you know, I'd like to know what we got versus what that's costing. Are they even equitable? You know, or are we, oh, you have
I
it
I can
already.
Actually answer that. For general fund, the cost is going to be right around $2.5 million.
How much?
$2.5
million. $2.5 million right now right. to bring everyone that's not at 15 up to 15.
That's paid for from the general fund.
Yes. Correct.
Okay.
From the general funds only.
General grant-funded positions.
Okay.
All funds, which would include EDEP, food service, those, is right around 3.5. So it's about another million out of those other categories.
Okay. So a total, so $1 million out of the other categories.
And that does include about $275,000 out of ESSER. Just
and $275,000.
Yeah, that is included in that additional $1
million. Okay. And that's non-reoccurring money. But the total then to get everybody to 15 starting on July 1 is $3.5 million.
That's correct. All funds.
Thank you.
Good question. Yeah.
You have a question?
Well, I have to get permission.
Sorry.
From the chair. Sorry. Oh, thank you, though.
Sorry.
I appreciate it.
Ms. Cuthbert.
Did we get any kind of flexibility on that 20-80 split from the government, from the DOE?
It's 50-50.
It's now 50-50?
It's now 50-50, yes. And just to add a little bit more to that, we have actually been meeting and having salary committee meetings with VUE for both support and instructional, and that's one of the things we're trying to address is how we're going to utilize that on a 50-50 split.
Is that for every school district or just us?
No, it's the state. It's everybody in the state if you've met the 47.5 minimum.
I can't tell you how grateful I am that Dr. Fritz and I wrote to the DOE about a year ago while I was still chair, pleading with the DOE to give us that flexibility because our veterans needed it, and especially if we have a different balance between new teachers and veterans. So I'm glad to hear that. I'm so glad to hear that. Maybe we did it and a few others did. I don't know how much jangling was affected, but it feels good as an elected official to know that somebody heard something and something was done. So I'm greatly, greatly appreciated that it's a 50-50 instead of 20-80. That's wonderful. Thank you.
Ms. Haynes.
Okay, so to piggyback off of that, because when we went to Tallahassee, every one of us talked about this. With all of our representatives. I thought, though, that once we met the 47.5, which we have met, and not all districts have met that yet. There are still districts that are under the 47.5. I thought we actually had the flexibility at that point that we could take the bulk of that funding, not a 50-50 split, but the bulk of that funding, and start with our most experienced teachers and work our way down.
Man.
And you know, and to raise the, and to deal with the compression, because what they kept telling us all along was you have to follow the 80-20 until you get to 47.5. I thought when I read the 50-50, that was still for the districts that are under the 47.5 that haven't gotten it because they've come into roadblocks and they're giving them the 50-50. I thought we still had the full flexibility that we can start at the top now, our most experienced, and start moving them up to deal with the compression issue that's been caused getting everybody to 47.5. So which is it?
We did too.
Yeah.
And what we are finding, and I see Elizabeth shaking her head back there, what we are finding is that as plans are submitted, interpretation of the statute becomes more clear. We thought the same thing that you did. However, as the districts are submitting their plan, DOE is providing feedback that further clarifies what the intent of the legislation is, and our, I don't know if changing the rules of the game is the right word to use, but changing the rules of the game.
They're clarifying it in a different way than what we thought it was.
Correct. Correct. Because we thought we would be able to take the pot of money that we have, do what we need to try to open up that compression a little bit, but now it seems like they're trying to restrict again. So we are actually conferring with other districts, trying to make sure that we're all interpreting the same way, and I'm hoping to have a call with St. John's tomorrow, actually, to discuss with them, because they just settled, and so they are working on, you know, their language.
And understand, we're working very, very hard to come up with the most advantageous plan, particularly for our veteran teachers, because we recognize that. We had this discussion at the bargaining table many, many times, that we want to get there so we can work on those, that compression issue that we have. We recognize there is one. But when we submit the plan, it has to get approved in order for us to get the money. So we want to make sure that what we're writing is going to get approved. And that gets narrowed and clarified every time we send it up.
Okay, because, you know, I'm speaking for myself right now, but I think everyone else here agrees with me. Our whole goal, I mean, we pushed to get to that 47.5 so that we could then have that flexibility, because we knew until we got to 47.5, we didn't have any flexibility. Like, we had to follow the rules, and the thought was get us to 47.5 so we could then address our most experienced teachers and the compression issue, and we could start at the top then and work our way down. And even though I know that that could still be frustrating to those that had gotten to 47.5, but I mean, we went from 39.2 to 47.5. You know, 3 years ago it was 39.2, and 2 years later it was 47.5. And my goal was to start addressing those people that had the most time in and working our way down to do the compression, which is the same thing we're now going to be faced with the $15 per hour. You know, on July 1st, bringing everybody, keeping in mind that last year, as we headed into September, we had people at $9 and something an hour. So we've brought everybody from $9 and something an hour to $15, which is causing a compression, which then we're going to have to flip and do the same thing on. So I'm, you know, I personally, if I need to go talk to our representatives, because I've talked to them many times about this, I'm happy to go talk to them again, because I said to them, even when we met with them as a group, we've done what you asked us to do so that we could have this flexibility now to work on our experienced teachers and the compression. And so I'm fine with 50-50 being everybody still under 47.5, the group under, but I am not okay with it now that we got to where we needed to be. I want us to have that opportunity to do what's right by the teachers that have had the small increments and been sitting there.
And I can tell you that through the salary committees, that's exactly what we're trying to do, is to try to open that up. And we are going in with the mindset that, you know, obviously we want to be in compliance, but at the end of the day, we want to make sure that we're addressing, especially those teachers where we're finding it is about year 23 on, so that we can open that up a little bit more. And I know that the $15 an hour is definitely going to create another huge piece in some of those salary schedules, and we've already started looking at that as well. We anticipated that you all would be in support of starting at July 1, so we started our work early in trying to address that as well. Because really, ultimately, and I think Elizabeth will agree, we would love to be able to settle early in the fall so that everything is finished and out of the way, and we can focus on what we need to, which are the students.
And so I'm going to talk about the elephant in the room for a moment about the $15 per hour, and I'm just going to state this. You know, if last August you were at $9 and something an hour, and you are now entering this school year at $15 per hour, I need you to understand that you've gotten your raise. because the people that were at $15 or $15.30 an hour, that's the group. I just don't want to hear the people that are starting July 1 with 15 now want 17, you know, in bargaining, okay? Because I'm sorry, you just did what the 39.2 group did that went to 47.5. You just went from 9 something to 15 or 11 to 15 because we got everybody to at least 11 in bargaining. So I'm just stating that because I just don't want to see on social media once again that we're not respecting people, because we actually, when we went to Tallahassee, we asked for this $15 an hour. And Mr. Clone and Ms. Burnett will agree with me. We said we needed to get to 15 sooner than what the state plan was. And so that's why that legislation came to be that said the school systems would go to 15 as of October 1st this year. Otherwise, we'd still be following the plan, and this year the plan was to get to 11. That's where the state's at. Next year's 12. But, I mean, we've all made a concerted effort to go above what was expected, and we asked to get there sooner than later so that we could have the employees that we need for our students.
Very good. Thank you.
Mr. Clone.
Persons.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just want to make sure as I look at this last page here, where it says the 2022-23 conference, and that has the total state and local funding $515 million, so forth. So if you subtract the total local funding of $213,699 from the $515,976, then that's what the state has put in.
Yes.
Which is, just so you see, it's so locally it was $213,699 and the state was like $242,277, pretty close to an even split. The other thing to remember of that local funding and that total required local effort, which is the, of course, the millage rate that is applied to the property value. People who have owned their home for a long time are also protected by Save Our Homes and only pay a 3% increase. That's the max. So while home values may have soared, if you haven't moved in the last 3 or 4 or 5 years, you're still only paying 3% more in your property value. So a great share of that is being paid for by the people who have recently purchased homes and saw that huge increase. Justifiably so, though. Now,
thank you.
Don't understand that. But I'm just saying that is the way. I'm not saying it's fair. I'm just saying that is the system that we have, and it is in our Constitution, too. It's not something like the legislature can just change, and it's been that way since, I think it was passed in 95, 96, so it's been that way for a while. That's it, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
The next fund is ESSER, and we have received funds for ESSER 1, ESSER 2, and ESSER 3, as we have discussed previously. We tried to put together the current expenditures and how we've utilized ESSER funds, and then we also put a section of the recurring expenses. Just to note, those are the things that we need to look forward in the next couple of years as ESSER funding is being reduced and eliminated. The things that need to be identified to be shifted back to general fund. We just want to put those together that we were all in the know. And now we are at board discussions. We just put some ideas of some priorities that we know have been out there, but we're opening it up too.
These are in no particular order. They're just listed as things that in conversation we have heard, so it's really just a starting place. We're going to be adding to this list as the discussion takes place.
All right. Mr. Persis is lit up. Was that from before?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Did you want me to?
No, go ahead. You're number one. Anita's behind you.
Okay, well, if I'm looking at your printed list here, board priorities, I don't disagree with any of those that are on the list. It's, you know, like what's more important. I mean, we could talk about that for hours. I'm sure. Like to do all of them, of course. And then, you know, we one of the things that we hear so much about is that teachers don't have time to do all the things that we ask them to do. They don't even have the time to participate in all the training that we would like them to do. You know, I just think at some point we have to look at the teacher work schedule or their actual calendar and just see if there's, you know, is it time to actually add more days to their calendar. I'm not saying free days. I mean days that you'd actually get paid, so that not so much to extend the student school year, but to so that we can give teachers those opportunities to really get the training that they need to have and to do it in a way that is reasonable to absorb that training and not just try to cram it in when you're already overloaded and you're tired and, you know, it's not really having the effect that you would want. Now, I know every day that we add to a teacher's schedule, and if you do the daily rate and run that out, it gets into the millions quickly. I just do think that's something else that we just need to think about. And I mentioned professional training, but I guess that's in here. I mean, too, as part of our budget. I mean, you're always preparing for training, and so I just, you know, those are things that come to mind. Those are things that I think about a lot.
We do budget for professional development. A lot of that comes from grant funds.
From which one?
Grant-funded.
Oh, grant, yeah.
Like Title
II. Yeah, great. Yeah. Thank you. That's it, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Burnett.
Thank you. I was just wondering if employee wages included the benefits, too, such as insurance, because I think that's something that we definitely need to make a priority as well.
We can add that to the list. That's an easy add.
Yes. Thank you.
Thames.
Okay, so I'd like to start with the employee wage piece. I've been saying this for a long time, and I think it's very important that we do this. I actually think we need to put out a document to each individual that shows not just what their base salary is, but what their entire package is. Because I think people need to understand what the entire package is. Because sometimes, specifically, when a principal is wanting to employ someone for a position that's grant funded, because under general funding, like when you give them their staffing allocation, you just say to them, you get to hire this many teachers, you know, and sometimes they're in categories or, you know, this many for elementary or, you know, secondary and things like that. But they're never given, like, here's your budget. And you have to, like, for general funds, you have to hire your positions within this framework. So, you know, Mr. Persis may have a more experienced staff, and his staff at his school may cost, you know, $15 million more than what the staff at Ms. Cuthbert's school cost, but yet he has two less positions than what she has. But when you move into federal, you know, and grant money, they actually have to pay for that entire cost. So that, you know, because they automatically go, oh, well, the teacher's base salary is only $47,500, why are you trying to charge me $62,000? Well, because the actual cost of that teacher is $62,000 when you look at what their benefits piece is. So I would like to see that happen, and I've brought it up for a couple years now. Number two, I think, as I always say, we need to build our budget from the school level, the base level of the individuals that touch the children, whether it's transportation, schoolway cafe, teachers, and all that, and build it from there going up instead of from the top going down. And we haven't yet figured out, I think, that that's the top priority, but I think that it needs to be, because I think if we build it that way, then we will see where the true need is. I want teachers in classrooms before I want people at the district level. And every time I say it, people get angry, but I'm going to keep saying it. The other piece that I need to see on here is that part that is right now our reoccurring funds that are coming out of ESSER. I need a plan on how that's going to work, because we can say, well, we've got 2 years' time or 3 years' time, but we also know sometimes the state gives money and then they turn around and without much notice, they take it away. Because you haven't spent it yet. And it's happened to us during this pandemic. I mean, we've had to give money back. And so I said from day one when we started getting ESSER, it couldn't be reoccurring funds. But yet we've got stuff under there. And even this past week while we were in Tampa at the FSBA training, some great questions came up about the progress monitoring piece. And you know, there were districts saying, well, but we hear that we've got the progress monitoring piece, but, and the state's going to pay for that piece, but they're like, but we have this program over here and that program over there, and we still want to do this. And the whole idea is we're supposed to bring the testing piece down and have less assessment of these children in this progress monitoring piece. And, you know, when we found out a year ago there was a program that was free that, but we weren't utilizing it under ESE at the state level, I think we need to take a step back. And so this is a priority of mine. If the state offers us something that they are picking the cost up on and we're not using it and we're buying X, Y, and Z over here and spending millions of dollars on this, I need to know why we're not using what the state's offering for free and why we're buying X, Y, and Z, because that's another way to save money. And so that's my thoughts on this. But I appreciate everything you've done, and I appreciate the way you laid this out and the answers you've given us.
Ms. Cuthbert.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think a priority is anything that supports student success. For example, our pre-K programs, we have to keep them very robust. I'm very delighted that we have AVID programs in our middle schools and high schools. That needs to continue. Our middle school redesign is meant to help our teachers with less student behavior, more team efforts to address students and their parents. Anything to reduce the teacher-student ratio, if we can have, I know we have a shortage, but if we can say we want more teachers to help reduce that at all possible. A robust summer school when we deal with the learning gaps, especially in the next several years. Not just for remediation, but for advancement, that program. Money for mentoring and tutoring, plus this opportunities for a lot of our instructors to earn extra money. And more than anything, I think in times, especially in the next couple of years, alternative behavioral opportunities, and not just justice and what faith restorative practices, but other, I guess, expert opinions to assist. And we just finished a lot of our new policies incorporating the ADA compliance, and with the DOJ, we need personnel, we need paras, we need additional counselors to help reduce the ratio. I know that at the secondary level, it's about 450 student per 450 students per counselor, and it's the counselors at their elementary levels that are now are becoming thinner. So we have a new school, Terry T. Small, being planned for 850 or 875 student stations. They're going to need at least two or three guidance counselors. So anything that can promote student success. Now, all of what you promoted, absolutely, that's all operational. We need it to make it happen. Safety and security is also primary for student success, because if students don't feel safe and secure or well-fed or, you know, have a clean environment, which I'm glad we have our pilot programs for our custodials, that too is very, very important. But if we don't have that in place, students won't succeed. So my priority is any program, any policies, any interest or hiring we can do to help our students succeed. So thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. And so for me, I think as we look at the budget priorities, and I've said this before, and I think Ms. Haynes, I'll echo what you said about starting with the classroom. And so I think this year should be about people, people, people. We've realized the importance of our people. We realize the importance of having them. We have felt what it's like not to have them. And you can have as many computers as you want. If you put 100 kids in an auditorium to do schoolwork, they're not learning. And so I appreciate the order in which these were put, and I realize they're in no uncertain order, but people, 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 and relationships. And mind you, you can't put a budget item on the budget line item that talks about relationships and people. But sometimes how we recognize folks makes a difference. How we make folks feel valued, and trust me, everyone in a hospital is sick of pizza. We don't want any more pizza. However, when it shows up, we tear it up. But I think that we really need to invest in people. And it's very easy to buy the next shiny program. You said you've been here 29 years. How many shiny programs have you seen in your lifetime, and how many of those are still here today?
Seen many, and not many are still here. Though several of them are still here, but not all.
Yet I'm sure you can.
We're still doing a lot of the homegrown ones.
Yet we have a teacher at Enterprise who's been here for 45 years.
Wow.
And so I think that's, to me, where our priority needs to be. And for me, I all of these shiny things are great, but the reality is that nothing replaces people. And so I'd be curious to see, and I know that your folks are very creative, to see what it would look like if we put people first and then things. You know, maybe we need to cut back technology by a percentage. Maybe we need to cut back, hey, maybe we don't have the money to buy that new blah. Maybe we have to wait an extra year to get that, whatever that is. I'm not even being specific on that. But I think that, you know, yeah, we've got wages on here. They're working on that. And I understand good work is going on around that right now. I'm confident that's going to get us pretty well. But my perception, and I just got here the other day, okay, is that we have, and this is Ruben's perception, not a board perception. I don't know if anybody else feels this way, but we always tend to see what's left for our people. What's left after we buy this, whatever this is. And so I think, you know, I'm excited about the employee wellness and health that we're investing in. That's an investment in people. I'd love to see recognitions be a little bit more pronounced. I mean, I never realized, and mind you, I just got here the other day, how much a pin means to somebody when it's a year late. A pin. I mean, they wait the whole year for that pin to show up. And so, you know, when we have folks that are retiring, and I get it, we're in public, you know, this is public service, but you have folks who are retiring and,
here's your retirement pin. You know, I think we may be able to do better on some of those things that help to raise the morale. You all, if you've been here long enough, you all have been on the roller coaster of people. You know, people come, people go. And so I think that that's probably, for me as a board member, where my priorities would be is human, it's people. You know what? We could buy more computers another day. Because if you don't have a teacher, guess what? So that's, you know, everything else is important because, you know, all this lines up to people. If their classrooms aren't clean, they're not happy. So custodians are important. And I think that the funny part about it is the very last comment, and I'm done after this, is doing all of these things while maintaining the financial conditions ratio. And so that's where I think you all could be creative. Yes. And then, you know, the other thing that Jamie always says that I always agree is let's staff classrooms. You know, maybe, you know, and it's not to say that there's anybody walking around doing nothing. Everybody's got 10 hats on. There's no question about it. But what's most important is the classroom. And I think that as we, you know, and I'd encourage Hazel, as we look at our allocations, you know, CTE classrooms, I'll never forget Ms. Johnson when she was here getting an award. She said, our classes are so full, you know. And so at what point does it become unsafe? So maybe we have to look at that because all of that goes into people and how they feel and how they feel they're valued. If you start your year with 210 kids on your roster, even though we know, give it a week or two, we're going to clean it up, but that really hurts at the beginning. And sometimes some classes didn't even have enough chairs for them. How does that happen? I don't even know. But anyways, that's all I have. As far as priorities, people. Let's put people first. And guess what? Before we know it, we'll have waiting lists of folks who want to come here. Because I can tell you, there are folks who have gone other places, and guess what? There is something about Volusia. And I think we can get back there where folks will give us 45 years of their life, or at least 30 for that matter.
Yeah.
Somebody turn off my mic.
Good.
I saw that.
45 years.
Mr. Persis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well said. We definitely are in the people business. I don't know, 80, 82% of our budget now goes to people kinds of things. But I wanted just to piggyback on a couple of things other people have said. Safety and security, does that include mental health people and programs?
We do have a mental health allocation that comes through the form of a grant, and we have safety and security grants as well.
Right.
So out of the general fund,
we have some on the FEFP as well. Yes.
Yeah, and I understand that there's going to be an increase in that grant funding for next year.
Yes.
For this purpose, correct?
It is one of the, I mean, you always win some, you lose some in those categories, right? And
right.
So that is one of the ones, it is being increased, yeah.
Great. I also wanted to say I definitely agree on whatever we can do to add more preschools. I think that's awesome that we should. I also think that what Jamie's been saying for 2 years, I think should be part when employee signs their contract, that we show them the whole benefits package that they get, and including the contribution we make to FRS and everything, so that they see how much the district is putting in to their not just salary, but salary
investing
and
in the
benefits. It's an eye-opener when you see that. And I think everybody should see it. And just lastly, another thing that we've kind of kicked the can down the road for a while is the assistant principal salaries, maybe district-wide salaries. They are
they are all over the place, and there's really no rhyme or reason for some of it. I know each. I know there was a good argument for why that person gets the salary that person makes now, but when you just look at everybody's, it's hard to figure out why sometimes some person is making so much less or so much more than someone else that is in the exact same category. So maybe, Ms. Superintendent, that can be something you can kick to the next superintendent. But I think at some point we have to take a look at it. I know Mark's just dying to do that because he has nothing else to do. But
really, non-bargaining is looser because it is not something that we bargain from year to year. So that changes as, but yeah, I agree.
That's it, Mr. Chair.
And I think at one point we did have a consensus to look at every position and maybe get a consultant, and I don't like the word consultant, but they have the extra time to go through each of the positions and look at the salaries in the community. I can tell you, in my organization, the folks who had been here forever, they got a $6 and $7 an hour raise because they were that far behind, and folks had just started. Some got a 32-cent raise because they were that much higher. And so, you know, you don't know where you're going if you don't know. And so we all hear, you know, in this neighboring county, I can make this much more. But, you know, what is the insurance like? What is this like? What is that like? What is the other like? And so so I know we had consensus, and I'll chat with Carmen about that when she gets here. Anybody else have anything else? All right. Hearing none, this meeting is adjourned. Thank you all once again.
Very helpful. So now you know, right?